I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, Eric Epstein of RockTheCapital.com going to be here talking about the DeWeese verdict. Also, maybe some of the redistricting stuff we can get him to go into, and maybe something on the Delaware loophole as well. In the second hour, Shane Larson, CWA legislative director, going to be here talking about the FAA vote that going to be happening any time now. Is this a moment where the Democrats cave again and hand off another bit of labor workers' rights off to the Republicans, who have been hell-bent on really going full bore at destroying any right a worker has at organizing or making their condition better? So we'll find out about that. Also in the second hour, Mike Konzol, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, going to be here talking about privatization nation. You know, as we go down the road, more of what is ours being auctioned off. Here in the state of Pennsylvania, they've been just chomping at the bit, figuring out how can we sell those liquor stores? How can we get rid of those stores that are providing decent jobs to people and controlling the substance? No, they want liquor on every impulse shelf. They want to hand that off for virtually nothing if you look at the numbers, to the big box stores. To the big supermarket chains. You know, this guy's, we're going to have mom and pops. Nonsense. It'll be an interesting conversation. In the third hour, Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, going to be here to talk about the Channel 21 unemployment. I hate to call it a news segment because it's just wrong. The segment itself was flat wrong, ideologically driven. It was motivated strictly by talk radio type messaging, but they did this segment. I talked about it last week, where they found somebody dumb enough to come out and say, "Hey, yeah, I was collecting unemployment benefits while I was sitting in jail, and oh, by the way, it was my girlfriend who was calling fraudulently as me." Yeah, I broke the law, but it's an unwritten thing here in jail because now I'm a hardened criminal. So it'll be interesting to hear what Rick has to say about that, because he evidently sent a letter to them and also the Department of Labor and Industry and some other folks. Because, as I said last week, the guy admitted to a crime. Will WHP 21 turn around and say, this is the person? We'll turn them over. Will they? Are they constitutionally protected? It'll be interesting to find out. But, it's amazing to me that anyone would step forward and say, I committed a crime and my girlfriend did too. And I said last week, he's going to be looking for a new girlfriend. Kind of reminds me of something my grandfather always used to say. He would say, make sure you're the only one who knows if you're screwing something up. Because then you got about a 50% chance of not getting ratted out. It turns out he was right. Looks like the guy ratted himself out. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you want to email me, Rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the big game yesterday, It's actually a very good game. This morning we woke up and we put the kids to bed just before halftime because it's their bedtime. They woke up and, "Who won the game, Mom? Who won the game?" My wife's like, "I don't know." And I'm like, "You sat there for 4 hours watching the game. You don't know who won?" She goes, "No, I only watched the commercials." And that's when it dawned on me, you know. This is why we're seeing all of the women broadcasters and all of the women stuff into football, to get my wife to sit there and watch the commercials. That's all it's about. So if you watch the commercials, there were some pretty interesting ones. For the most part, I think this was a down year for the most part. There have been some funny ones in the past, some good ones, not so much. And for $3.5 million for a 30-second ad, I would assume that, you know, you would be, well, maybe you spent all the money in getting the ads and not so much on actually doing production work. But anyway, the president sat down with Matt Lauer during the halftime and said, you know, "Hey, I absolutely deserve a second term." He said, "We're not going to, if you remember during the State of the Union, he said, "We're not going to go back to an economy weakened by outsourcing bad debt and phony financial profits." Well, yesterday he sat down with Lauer and said, "You know what? I deserve a second term." And then said, "You know, we're not done." And pointed out what I think most people need to remember. When he took office, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. This last month, they created 250,000. It's not setting the world on fire, but understand he has created more jobs than Bush did. And for 23 months in a row, we've seen some growth. The most manufacturing jobs since 1980, which a good thing, don't you think? I mean, we've been losing, hemorrhaging jobs for over a generation now. Kind of upset me with the whole coal and natural gas thing, but, you know, did say, "Hey, we need to get some clean energy in there," so I was happy about that. Pandered to the American working, we need to upgrade our skills. We're doing the right thing, making progress. I think we should be doing more, but good luck on the Republicans coming along for that. So a good commercial that I saw, and I wanted to talk about the Chrysler ad, because one, what caught me, and I don't know if you saw the ad, it was a little over two minutes at halftime. They had Clint Eastwood, who is a solid Republican. I mean, a heavy donor to the Republican Party. I'm not as crazy as the party has gotten, a more mainstream kind of Eisenhower-type Republican of the past. Maybe not the T-twit kind today we seem to see taking over. But, you know, he came out and said, "Look, you know, we're at halftime, America. It's halftime." And talked well about Detroit. Said, "Look, you know, something's going on there. They're expanding jobs." He said they almost lost everything and then pulled together. And now the Motor City is fighting again. And, you know, he goes back and he says, "Look, I've seen some tough eras, a lot of downturns in my life, times when we didn't understand each other. It seemed we'd lost our heart at times. A fog of division, discord, and blame made it hard to see what lies ahead." And you listen to that and you go, is that a political statement? And I think it absolutely has to be. This is, for me, you know, if I'm Eastwood, all I can think of that's in his mind is, "Hey, you know, I want my party to come back to the reality." If this is a political statement. Now, the righties went nuts saying, you know, Chrysler's, you know, pandering to the Obama administration, as if I were the Chrysler and I were pandering to somebody, he's who it would be. I'm not going to be pandering to the people who wanted to destroy me. Now, you look at Romney, he's already come out and said, "Look, I would have made him go through bankruptcy." And, you know, Zach Womp was another guy. Well, you know, hey, you know, let him go through bankruptcy, you know, because in his place, you know, where the car company's there in Tennessee, they pay less wages and less health care. And somehow in his world, that's just fine, well, dandy, and good. In my world, that's really not a great thing.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a cost with less health care. Why okay. Should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson.
You know, and that's the Romney position. you know, should have let him fail. So all of this movement forward, all of this job creation, all of this stuff would have not happened. And we would have gone further down, further down, further down, which is where they wanted us, so that the investors can come in and suck us up, break them up, sell them off, all of that stuff. And you look at General Motors, who just, they're expected here in the next day or two to announce profit at record levels for 2011. Now think about that. Had we let them just go and done the Bain-style thing, which, you know, they would have broken parts of it up, they'd have sold parts of it off, they'd have cut parts off to die, and made the U.S. auto industry basically dead, completely uncompetitive, which is what they wanted. Because, you know, what's weird, and this is one of those things that's very hard for me, because, you know, I am an American first. But you look at those senators who are down in Alabama and Tennessee and Georgia and Kentucky and all these Republican senators who you have to look at what they did, which was vote against the nation. Because we want to let those American companies collapse. Why? Because, hey, we got Volkswagen in our area. We got Hyundai in our area. Hey, we got Kia in our area. So we can let those American companies go, because we've got the foreign companies coming in that have created a couple of jobs with massive subsidy from the government, mind you. And that's where their mindset was. So this has got to really be biting them in the behind, because as Eastwood said, you know, we don't get knocked out with one punch. And the auto industry hasn't been knocked out with the one punch. So I'm happy to see that, but I think this is going to be a massive election year issue, and it should be. So I'm going through some of the other commercials, and I see this one with Pete Hoekstra. And it's one of those moments where you go, did someone really advise him to this, or did he just make it up on his own? What, you know, where did this come from? So Debbie Stabenow is the senator right now, the Democratic senator from Michigan. Now, Hoekstra wants to beat her, so he runs this ad. Now understand, it's this Chinese girl, supposedly, on a bicycle in China. So you see her riding up, see the visual of the ad, and this is what she says.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy gets very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spendetnow.
I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spendetnow and Pete Spendetnot. I'm Pete Spendetnot Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you go, really? Have you stooped that low? And when he says, I'm Spendetnot guy, does that mean... We're going to refuse to invest in anything? Because that's what he's saying. So everything's going to crumble because he's Mr. Spend It Not. But, you know, hey, desperation will make you do weird things. And one of the most weird commercials I saw was the Hyundai commercial with Matthew Broderick, where he plays the Bueller character again. And I guess it was an interesting choice, given the fact, according to his Wikipedia page, he was involved in a fatal car accident in 1987 where he crossed the center line and killed a mother and her daughter, and got off with a fine. He was convicted of a charge of careless driving and fined $175. So you kind of got to wonder there. And the other good moment of the Super Bowl, I'm sure you saw it, Limbaugh was caught picking his nose. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Since December 18th, a couple dozen retirees of a Century Aluminum plant in Ravenswood, West Virginia, have occupied a median along Route 33. They call their encampment Occupy Century Aluminum and say they've taken this action to fight a company that has kicked hundreds of retired employees off of health care. After shuttering the West Virginia smelter in early 2009, Century Aluminum began terminating health benefits for retirees in June of 2010. After nearly 2 years of trying to get the company's attention, the retirees found inspiration in the 99% movement. Karen Gorrell, at 62, is the youngest resident of Occupy Century Aluminum.
It's easy to say retirees are losing health care. It's easy to say there's devastation created. But people need to know the real stories, the real true impact, one by one, of what this is doing to retirees. We had a gentleman that passed away, Sam McKinney, on February the 14th. It will soon be a year ago. And he had attended one of our meetings, and he was beside himself because his wife was very ill and losing her health care, and he didn't know what he was going to do to take care of her. And he ended up leaving our meeting. He was just next to tears, and he drove up the road with his wife to have Valentine's dinner, and they ate dinner. And he came out and died in the parking lot within minutes. And his last day on this earth, he had said to his wife, "The day I married you, I knew I could take care of you for the rest of my life. And Century has stolen that ability from me. And if I were to die today, I don't know what would happen to you." And that was Sam McKinney's last day on this earth.
Gorrell said the images on television of Wisconsinites fighting for their rights were inspirational. She said it helped teach the world that unless you use your voice, you'll lose your voice.
You know, I watch that every day on TV, you know, in Wisconsin. And my goodness, you know, the support and the love that went out to the folks there. I wanted to be there so bad. Of course, we were right in the middle of our own battle. But I wanted to be right there in the middle of it. I just wanted to be right there with you all. And, you know, I love what you're doing. And we're just so grateful and proud. And you know, it's spreading, and if we all stand united, they can't beat us. You know, I always say, if you believe you can, you will, and if you think you can't, you won't. And we got to believe that we can take this country back, and we've got to unite and fight back. And it may take the senior citizens in this country, you know, that have endured and been through it all, to be some of the leaders in this fight.
For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me.
Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Pennsylvania State Representative Bill DeWeese was found guilty today of 5 of 6 counts of theft, conspiracy, and conflict of interest. DeWeese said he would continue his reelection bid because, in a court of public opinion, he claims he will be favorably received. The representative was asked whether he still maintained his innocence, to which he responded, "I certainly feel I did nothing wrong." Going on to say that if the jury were from his area, Western Pennsylvania, that they would have acquitted him of all charges. So is this just normal politics? Is this selective prosecution? Or is he just the one that got caught? Here to talk about that is Eric Epstein from RockTheCapital.com. Eric, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, no problem, my friend.
So, selective prosecution or just the guy who got caught?
You know, I sat through the trial last week, and I was there for Bill's testimony, the cross-examination, and the closing. I think what's problematic about this case is that the jury, you know, convicted him of wrongdoing in you know, at that level, I don't have a problem, Rick. But I think the problem is that is pretty widespread in terms of political campaigning. And, you know, there was a lot of money and a lot of time put into trying to convict DeWeese on Bonusgate. You know, they were able successfully to ensnare other folks who, in my mind, should have been convicted. Bill was probably guilty of this. I mean, that's not the issue. The issue is resources. How much resources are you really going to use to pursue political campaigning? One person could say, hey, they went after Bill. Makes sense. Why didn't they go after Jane Orr?
And why haven't they gone after all of the other Republicans and everybody else? I mean, if you're going to choose one, don't you have to go after the other?
Well, I think that the problem is, people have lost focus, is that it's been chamber-centric. In other words, they went after, some guys in the House who they should have for Computergate, namely former Speaker Purcell and then also Brett Feast, who is a high-ranking member. Then they went after a bunch of Democrats. That to me, that didn't bother me. What bothered me was that they didn't go after the chamber in which we asked them to investigate. Bonusgate, the investigation was supposed to go after the Senate. And anybody who's involved in politics know that three people that we had initially targeted haven't been presented or haven't gone to trial. And that's Mr. Nyquist and Mr. Crompton and Mike Long. They're still there. You know, so the thing that infuriates me is that it is a partial investigation. If you want to go after Mr. Purcell, fine. Mr. DeWeese, fine. Doesn't bother me, Mr. Vian. But you can't ignore, Rick, an entire chamber, which is what happened. You know, the Senate Republicans spent $2 million on defense. Nobody was presented. Drew Crompton got a bonus that year of about $18,000.
Wow.
Running the Lynn Swann campaign. He's still there. He's still there advising Scarnati, President Pro Tem. Mike Long is still there. He was Chip Brightbill's brother-in-law. You know, Nyquist is still there, right? So, you know, I'm more upset that there's a couple of things that we've asked for. First is we want to know how much the investigation cost. Secondly, we'd like to know the criteria for who you go after and who you don't go after. Because I think, you know, there are crimes of commission we need to go after, but then there's crimes of omission. You make a decision who you don't go after. I don't know how you don't go after the Senate Republicans.
Yeah, but who makes that decision?
The Attorney General.
So one could argue, as I have several times, that this was really a politically motivated thing, where first they had to make the Democrats look bad, which they did, and then they had to down the road to look fair, they had to go after a sacrifical Republican.
Well, I don't view the Republicans being sacrificial. I think people forget this.
No, I think they're all in this.
What I mean by that is I'm saying is, just because you're Republican doesn't mean, you know, you're an ally. Same thing, you know, with the Democratic Party. Just because, you know, people share the party.
True.
I think, you know, that Purcell was viewed prospectively as a, I don't know if enemy is the right word, but certainly adversary. You know, John Purcell, tough guy, Northeast Philly Republican, had a lot of power. And a lot of the Republicans didn't like him because he dealt with Rendell. But I think his days were numbered after the coup and he was changed out. I would say this, the amount of gusto that Corbett spent going after the House Democrats, if it was only a small measure of that used in the Senate, there'd be a lot more Republicans in jail.
Yeah, and the other part of it is, you know, at a time where we're talking about cutting all of this money from education and all
yeah.
of this, all the other programs, that tomorrow we're going to find out what the agenda is and where the priorities are, maybe this money could have been better spent.
Well, not only could it be better spent, I think, you know, the Sandusky case brought this up, and this is one of the things that DeWeese brought out, is that, look, you had 14 people going after me and only one person going after Sandusky. Was it a case of misplaced priority? I mean, at some point you have to ask yourself, what's more important? Going after a sexual predator or political cronyism. And you know, that was the Attorney General's call. My concern is, what other crimes have we not prosecuted because we've been obsessed with this?
Yeah.
And, look, he, like anybody else, I think it's safe to assume, viewed Bonusgate as a launching pad to the governor. He is not governor without Bonusgate. There's just no question in my mind.
Yep, because nobody knows his name.
Nobody knows his name, and it was just, and I still have concerns about, again, the criteria for how we prosecute. Political corruption is bad. Should we go after it? Yeah, but we should go after all of it. You know, I'm still wondering, where was he during the Luzerne County Kids for Cash scandal? You know, nowhere to be found. You know, same thing with FUMA. Same thing with Ori. You know, We have to make sure, I guess my concern is this, and I almost viewed, and tell me if this makes sense to you, Rick, in a lot of ways I viewed DeWeese as kind of like Klaus von Bülow. He was an unsympathetic person, but we didn't get him for what we thought we would, which was bonus gate, so right. Now we'll get him for this.
Yeah, I agree. And part of me goes, if you're going to drain the swamp, you got to drain the swamp, and you got to deal with the money issues and really have a clear, some clear oversight, which I still don't think we have.
Yeah, I don't think we have either, and I think, you know, one of the problems that's come out of bonus gate is that, you know, we really need those bright red lines. We can't really have, you know, any kind of electioneering going on, whether it's on comp time or lunchtime. You know, we need the bright red line. We still don't have it. It's really, really murky. We still have a patronage system, and Corbett abuses it just as much as anybody, Rick. I mean, look, the culture and Harrisburg in the last year has gotten scuzzier. I mean, we've got people in this cabinet from out of state that are either incompetent or just reckless. I mean, you know, when I look at the Secretary of Health, you know, I don't know what he's doing there. We just hired a guy, DPW, who believed women should be barefoot and pregnant, you know.
And lead semen-exposed lives, which yeah. I just found, I had to chuckle over that.
Well, I would chuckle if it wasn't so serious. You know, the Department of Public Welfare is now bigger than the Department of Education. And, you know, I hear Mr. Corbett saying how he's reduced the budget, but actually he's increased taxes. Almost every school district has to raise taxes because he cut public education. I mean, dude, wake up.
Do you think people will put two and two together and come to that final conclusion next election time? Because, you know, he took the pledge not to raise taxes, but all of us have had our taxes, especially those of us who work, have had our taxes raised.
Well, I think he's problems on three fronts. The first front is transportation. We've got a great transportation plan together. The transportation secretary could serve in any administration, and because it has an increase in fees, he's not going to support it. Our roads are crumbling. The bridges are falling down. It's moronic. Number two, he's going to have to do Marcellus Shale sooner than later. He's left $500 million at the table last year. If he leaves it again this year, I don't see him getting reelected. And the third thing is an intangible thing, Rick, which I've never experienced. I've met countless Republicans that simply won't vote for him based on the Paterno issue.
Interesting.
So Republicans, look, we did the polling, overwhelmingly support taxing Marcellus Shale. Republicans overwhelmingly support public education. And then you have the Penn State Nation who's not happy with the way Corbett handled the Paterno issue. So, and it's not really the Paterno issue. It's actually the Sandusky scandal. And you hear this a lot. I'm confident this guy's one term.
Yeah. I'm the more I see him, the more I think you're right.
Yeah. I mean, and he's not particularly sharp. The people around him are not going to win a Nobel Prize. I mean, you don't have to be the sharpest knife in the drawer as long as you have other people who know how to cut a deal or cut the bite. I mean, we have a feud going on, and I don't know if you guys talk about it in the show, between the Senate Republicans and the governor, between the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans.
Yep.
Well,
which is the reason we haven't seen a lot of the really ugly stuff that you saw in Wisconsin or Ohio or Indiana. They're not on the same page, and I'm quite happy to see that.
Yeah, and I don't think you're going to see much of that. I think redistricting has taken the air out of everybody's tires. So, you know, you have a lot of confusion, and, you know, we had appeal redistricting, you know, with some other groups, and, you know, it was just, I think the Republicans and the Democrats, because a lot of Democrats signed off on it, thought that they could drop the redistricting plan in at the last minute to the Supreme Court and get away from it. So you have redistricting, which is kind of taking the air out of the legislative agenda. You know, he's going to announce his budget tomorrow, so it looks like there's going to be more cuts in higher education. He's alienated. He's isolated. And, you know, the political capital he may have had is gone. They are going to force him to do Marcellus Shale.
He's going to have to. I mean, in fact, reports were today, you could see a vote as early as today on some type of a fee.
Yeah.
According to reports.
Yeah, when I was in the House last week, the only thing keeping it from happening was the issue of local control. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that I think Senator Scarnati is really smarting over his Super Bowl trip last year from Consol Energy.
Yeah.
So I'll give him credit. You know, he's really, you know, Senate Republicans are pushing pretty hard, but Marcellus Shale has to happen. There's 35 states that exploit the mineral. We're the only state that doesn't tax it. There's 10 states that extract more Marcellus Shale. They tax it. Look, Rock the Capitol, we called last year the guy who innovated fracking, George Mitchell.
Right.
He couldn't believe we didn't tax it.
I can't believe we don't. Look, when we're pulling West Virginia down, there's a problem. When we're the reason that West Virginia's living conditions are going to get worse because they're going to have to lower a tax to compete with us, there is an absolute problem.
There's not only a problem, is I think one of, people need to understand these are substantial corporations. You have substantial multinational and foreign corporations that are buying out the leases at record pace. You know, the French are here now. The Chinese are here. Exxon is here. Chevron's here. You know, who the hell are we giving a tax break? This is insanity, dude. I mean.
Well, did you see the story last week Royal Dutch Shell.
Yeah.
Is looking at building another refinery somewhere in Pennsylvania, somewhere in West Virginia, somewhere in Ohio, and all they're asking for is, well, total tax abatement and a whole boatload of economic development money.
Yeah. And at some point, people need to understand that we're more competitive. Ohio has earthquakes. West Virginia doesn't have the same infrastructure. You know, it's the same thing. We just posted an article on Rock the Capitol. I'm sure you guys talk about this, with this friggin' Delaware loophole, man. I mean, we're giving away the store.
Yeah, it's they've got that magical box over there.
Yeah, you're just giving away the store. But I would say from where I'm standing, and the Democrats need to solidify their base, have a message, get more aggressive, is that you have a governor that's wounded and is not going to change out personnel. These political corruption trials are going to end soon. I think Jane Orey, you know, still has one coming up. We still have one with Steve Stettler. Then there's one in the Northeast. At some point, people are going to have to hunker down and deal with what we're supposed to be dealing with. That is making people's lives better. We're not doing it.
And doing what government's supposed to be doing. The things that we individually can't do for ourselves, we do collectively through our government.
Yeah, I just think, and again, this is me, what I'm seeing here, and I've never seen this before, is you have a governor that, you know, he got vaulted to power, the so-called white knight crusader. He was none of that. That was a false premise. He is stuck. You know, he doesn't have good legislative skills. He doesn't have good executive skills. And, you know, tomorrow I think he's going to do it again. He's going to take a scalpel to vital services.
If it were only a scalpel, I don't know that I'd be all that upset. It seems like he's taking a chainsaw.
Yeah. It's strange because, you know, you're dealing – the Senate tends to be more moderate than the House. And what I think is going to be strange or at least interesting, and what I would tell your listeners to look at, the budget hearings for Penn State this year, I think, are going to be bombastic. It's just going to be a carnival, and I think they're going to take a big hit. And then I think, you know, when the judiciary comes down after the redistricting decision and ask for an increase in their funding, I get the sense that they're not going to be warmly received.
No, not so much. Well, let me ask you. I got about a couple minutes left. This redistricting thing.
Yeah.
I look at the lawsuit that the Republicans filed for the 2001 lines, trying to undo that. And to me, my thought on it is I just think that they don't want to have to go through a primary. Just want to get right to the general election and not to screw around with that, because then you can't redraw the lines and who knows where this ends up. So basically, do we not have an election? What's their idea going forward if we're going to go undo the 2001 line? Because they don't have a plan. There's no new map, as I understand.
Yeah, that was a Hail Mary. Sam Smith, the Speaker of the House, you know, appealed the redistricting decision, saying that the 2001 would work. But that's too bad. I mean, the 2011 was so egregious, and so many municipalities and political subdivisions got arbitrarily carved up, that the Supremes had no other choice. I mean, I'm surprised it was only 4-3. We had filed a motion to have Judge Ori Melvin removed, since she's the subject of a presentment. You think, wow, you know, there's a no-brainer. Of the 253 people affected by redistricting, your sister also happens to be a senator, by the way.
For now.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look at the Supreme Court's decision, they really hammered the Legislative Reapportionment Commission.
But why not? Why now? Instead of, I mean, 2001 doesn't look any better than 2011 did.
Yeah, what's interesting, it's a good point, because 2001 was also carved up by the Republicans. 2001 was carved up by the R's. 2011 was carved by the R's. I think you're to a point, if you look at the decision and if you look at some of the suggestions that were made on the appeal by Amanda Holt, Rick, we have computer software. You can do it in a non-political way. It doesn't have to be as egregious. I think everybody bet the House. that they were just going to back the Supreme Court up, and the Supreme Court would have to swallow this bitter pill. And they didn't. And the deciding vote came from the Supreme Court Justice, Ron Castile. And although he's a Republican, he's a tough guy. Ex-Marine, lost a leg in NAM, well-decorated. He ain't going to back down. I think what happens is you have two options. One, you could actually schedule the primary for September, which the politicians don't want, because then you're going to have to run on your record. Or two, and I think it's more likely the primary will occur when it's supposed to. It's going to be confusing. And we are going to use the 2001 lines, Rick. I don't know what else is up there.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be what's going to have to happen. And I think you're absolutely right. They're going to have to run on what they've actually done.
The only other option is if they use this Amanda Holt district. And I don't know how you do that, because then you'd have to put everybody back. You know, the petition deadline is almost done.
Yeah, because I think there's, 30 days public input time, and then 30 days before the primary has to be in.
Yeah, but the petition, in order to qualify, you know, the signatures on your petition will already be filed. So I still have people calling me not knowing what district they're running in.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's a point. Yeah, so you absolutely have to use the 2001.
Yes, yeah, that's going to happen. That's going to be look, this has turned out to be a fiasco, but it was a planned train wreck. They have nobody to blame but themselves. I've got no sympathy. That was it looked like Picasso on acid drew these lines. And then they waited to the last second to dump them off, and they got caught.
And we'll see where this all takes us. And again, it's one of those things where you go,
remember, too, is this. At the end of the day, the judges now have created a precedent where redistricting can be challenged successfully. So whatever happens next, Democrat or Republican, needs to be really, really careful. And if you read this decision, it was biting, Rick. I mean, they went after the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, and basically said, hey, folks, this was a planned train wreck. And about the timing issue, you know, that everybody's complaining about, they basically said, tough. If you'd done it right the first place, essentially the Supreme Court said it's not up to us to clean up your self-imposed hardship.
Right.
But the good thing for people, depending on their, on my political stripe, the good thing is there's so much confusion that bad things aren't getting passed.
And that's where I'm at. Eric Epstein, always great talking with you. I appreciate it. RockTheCapital.com, the website. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Anyone who has participated in a public demonstration is used to seeing police with video cameras recording us commoners as we dare to exercise our constitutional right to protest. Authorities insist that being videoed should not worry demonstrators, as long as they're doing nothing wrong. But what happens when the cameras point the other way? Cell phones and video cameras are now ubiquitous, so police agents frequently find themselves being recorded doing everything from traffic stops to arresting protesters. This has exposed police abuse and even led to some convictions of agents caught roughing up the citizenry. But it has also produced a police backlash against camera-wielding citizens. Across the country, irate cops have been arresting people for the crime of filming police actions. Such states as Illinois have outlawed the recording of police without their consent, while Maryland and Massachusetts have even tried to stretch their anti-wiretapping laws to prosecute citizen videographers. Some judges are going along with this, saying that, quote, meddling citizens should not be bothering authorities. As one barked from the bench last October, I'm always suspicious when the civil liberties people start telling the police how to do their business. Well, excuse me, your powder-headed honor, but us meddling citizens fought a revolution 236 years ago against King George III's red-coated authoritarians, so we could indeed tell the police how to do their business. It's the American way. This is Jim Hightower saying, the good news is that a federal court of appeals ruled last year that we the people do have a constitutional right to record police actions in a public place. After all, If they're doing nothing wrong, the authorities should not worry about anyone videoing them. The camera is simply a democratic tool. It empowers citizens to be their own watchdogs.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Fascist, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to fight. You fascists abound.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Or check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the website's the best place to go. Or if you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So, you know, I look at this thing with DeWeese, and, you know, Eric's right. How much money did we spend? How much resource did we spend going after these handful when there's a whole bunch of other things? You know, I think he brought up the prison gate, the cash for kids thing up in the Scranton area. That was huge. The Sandusky thing. One person investigating that, really? And they chose to look the other way. This, in my opinion, if you did it, you deserve to go to jail. Was not heartbroken by the Vion verdict. If he did it, there's a place for him. But how much time, energy, resource did we put into the aftermath? Why weren't we doing anything? I was no cop on the beat. This is where, you know, each side is supposed to keep each other honest instead of colluding. So there you go. Anyway, I spent this past weekend going through some archives at the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO for a research project that I'm working on. I was over at the state capitol going through their archives, and, you know, the state capitol's, their archives are just phenomenal and cumbersome. You know, the great thing about this past weekend is I was able to go through a whole bunch of stuff very quickly as we're in the state archives. Wow, good luck on that, getting anything quickly, because it's so, the system is tough, because you want to keep that stuff in perfect order. You want to make sure, and I get all that. But as I'm going through this, looking for stuff for my research project, I came across, you know, just tons of stuff that reminded me. And I know working people have been under attack from day one. But to have 50 years of that attack staring you right in the face just kind of stops you in your tracks. You know, I was researching some stuff on workers' compensation. But, you know, you just issue after issue, unemployment comp, health care, prevailing wage, pensions, you name it, this nonsensical no rights at work agenda laid out in 50 years. All right there. Back in the 80s, for instance, they were pushing for high-speed rail because they said it was going to create jobs. Much like we're saying now, if only we would have done it back in the 80s, you wouldn't have the traffic, the gridlock. You wouldn't have the immediate need for a transportation bill. And I came across some Tom Ridge stuff from when he was governor. And one of these shiny brochures that they sent out to all of the big businesses that they were trying to, lure from other states. And on it, you know, he came right out and said, look, we're cutting business taxes. We're slashing red tape. We're dismantling the bureaucracy, helping companies grow. And, you know, it just grabbed me. I mean, it's the same argument over and over and over again. Here it is, this business-friendly BS. It never changed. It's the same stuff. The only thing that I think has changed over the years from my grandfather's generation to us is the people. And I kind of get it. We get busy. Our attention, flows astray. We got kids. We got mortgages. Aunt Mabel's sick, whatever. But they never relent. The same no rights at work agenda stuff that you're hearing about them just passing the theft there in Indiana. Same stuff they were talking about 50 years ago. None of this stuff changes. They never relent. They never give up. They never take their eye off the prize. And when one of them goes away, they got 10 more to come take his place. And they start over and over again with the same rhetoric, the same BS, just a different fiddler. You know, I was looking at workers' conferences because that's, like I said, it was what I'm focusing on. You know, they've wanted from 50 years ago, for you to have to see the company doctor for 180 days. That was their magic number back then. All of the things that they wanted, all of the things that they've got today, and they've incrementally moved towards getting them. You look at the unemployment thing. You know, all these years since unemployment was brought into order, when people started actually paying into it and paying for it and getting it when they needed it, they've been trying to destroy it, trying to make the benefits less generous so people are more desperate to get back to work, and trying to make it more difficult to, you know, wasn't drug testing back then. It was availability. You had to actually go and show up at places. I mean, it was anything to make the obstacles and the roadblocks much more difficult. And I think back to my grandfather's generation, who wouldn't have taken this nonsense. They wouldn't have put up with it. What is it about us now that we're willing to take these attacks, that we're willing to put up with the assaults? Because the same issues came up then. The difference was that they were soundly rejected time and time and time again. But the radical right gets it. If they just keep throwing it out there, keep putting it out there, keep making their message, keep pounding away, eventually you change people's minds. Which is why in Philadelphia they've got two extremely conservative talk stations. And really, well, absolutely nothing of equal size or scope on any other perspective. And the idea, even though in Philadelphia it's, 8-1 Democratic registration to Republican? But what they know is they keep putting it out there. They keep putting it out there. You're going to be able to change the conversation. You're going to be able to change the dialogue. And I look at this thing, you know, we're going to talk with Rick Bloomingdale a little bit later about this CBS 21 so-called investigation. How well-timed was that? I mean, how perfect, when you stop and you think about it in the grand scheme of messaging, how perfectly timed was that? The jobs report came out, 250,000 new jobs created. You've got all these right-wing groups who are now saying, well, it's time to end the extensions of unemployment. Oh, well, we don't need to have unemployment anymore. Times are good, 8.3, that's wonderful. Time to do away with all those extensions. And there it is, it hits. You know, you're sitting there watching your evening show, just trying to relax, and it's right there in your face. It's right there. A news investigation that'll leave you fuming. We've learned that convicted criminals are beating the system by collecting unemployment money. Your tax dollars. While sitting in jail. Never mind the information that it isn't your tax dollars. It was the payments by the workers and the employee and the employers who pay into the fund. It's not your tax dollars, but you know, don't let facts get in the way. And they want you to believe that, wow, it just happens all the time. Even though they can't tell you who, what, when, because it's an unwritten rule in jail, evidently, according to their reporting, if you want to call it that. And then they get a guy to come on and admit the fraud. Admits his girlfriend committed fraud. And I want to know who signed the checks. I'm hoping the Department of Labor and Industry goes after this guy, finds him. And the girlfriend. They can go back to jail. Because both of them committed fraud. But you don't hear anything about that in the quote-unquote reporting. All you hear about is, well, you know, he collected money while sitting in jail, and there's a huge problem, and that's why we need to be more restrictive with. All the while, over in the House, there's legislation going through to be more restrictive. The idea is to continually chip away, chip away, chip away. Why is it we don't see any bills? Why is it we don't see things that are going to make it easier or more generous or more able to get by during that tough time? Well, because they've convinced us, man. We need to be more business friendly. They've convinced us. And a lot of people have bought it. Unemployment's a wonderful life. People don't want to get off of unemployment. It's luxury. It's luxury. I can go to Hawaii on food stamps, they tell me. Nonsense. They found one person out of the, 46 million people who are getting some degree of help. There was one person. And that's what they're going to base the destruction of the program on? And the answer is yes. I mean, if you look at issue after issue, they don't run out of time or money. Because they understand long view. They understand incremental movement. They push the big idea way out there. And then we compromise. We compromise. Because, you know, we're rational. Instead of saying, hell no, we're not going to do it, they say, well, meet us halfway, and that'll be compromise. Because we're used to doing that, right? They want 100% cut in some program, and the other side doesn't want any, so we'll meet somewhere in the middle. They want a 50% cut with that mentality. And who suffers? Well, we do. Now, I get this email, and I love these emails that I get occasionally, that tell me, well, you know, there are more people today looking for handouts than at any time in history. Because, you know, somebody's getting something for nothing. And we get these emails and we get all fumed, all lit up. Why should I have to pay for somebody who's lazy and not doing anything? I'm going, part of me goes, well, how is it that 50% of the people are paying for the other 50%? How is it that 50% of the people, so they say, has all the resource? And if you were to really then break it down, what percentage of the top actually has all the resource? And as I wrote back to my aunt who sent me this email, who's, you know, laid out, you know, from the founding of the country, you know, well, founded on corporate people coming together, and it's really just conflated. But at the end of it, it says, you know, half of the people are paying for the other half. And then the number's getting bigger of people who want something for nothing. And I'm going, well, you know, I look at the Romney situation. You know, my aunt makes a reasonable $40,000-$45,000 a year, maybe $50,000. Why is it that he pays the same tax rate that she pays? Shouldn't we be having that conversation? And, you know, when I posed it to her in those terms, you know, she started to think about it. Well, you know, maybe you've got a point. Maybe we're focused on the wrong thing. And we've been led to focus on the wrong thing fairly consistently. Fairly often we focus on what they tell us to focus on, where the shiny thing is, where they want to make sure that our attention's moved away so that while they're picking our pockets, maybe we don't pay attention. The same thing with this whole no rights at work agenda. Now that Indiana's passed the, and again, right to work, nonsense. There's no right. There's no work. But Ohio, they've got some ballot language now. We talked about this last week. That's going to put it on the ballot. There's a part of the conservative movement that hopes this is how we're going to rally the base. This is how we're going to get people to get out there and vote. And I go back to this. When does it end? You know, I think they resoundingly in Ohio said no to destruction of collective bargaining. But here they are, right back again. Why? Deep pockets. Lots of billionaire money, lots of business class money. And you and I are the ones that get hurt in all this. Because we're the ones who get less health care. We're the ones who have a lower standard of living. Why? Insane tax rates. You know, I look at this new report by the folks over at the Corporation for Enterprise Development. They point out that in every state in the U.S., the top 1% of the taxpayers pay a smaller share of their income in state taxes than most of the people at the bottom 20%. They say the median difference, well, in the most typical states, the poor pay state taxes at twice the rate of the rich. Because understand, those folks at the top, they make sure they use every deduction, every loophole, everything that's right there for them. You know, here in Pennsylvania, they talk about, oh, we've got the highest tax rate, one of the highest tax rates in the country. But we've got that magical box. We've got that magical box over there in Delaware. And what does that do? Well, that allows them to move their profits somewhere else. That allows them to, well, you know, we can have these subsidiaries who they set up specifically to drain profits out of the state. They call them private investment company subsidiaries, or PICs. And the most famous one, of course, is Jeffrey the Giraffe, the guy from Toys R Us, where they've set up this corporation just for Jeffrey the Giraffe, and they pay all of their profits to Jeffrey through the magic box in Delaware. And you and I, we get stuck picking up the tab again and again. And I look at this story from Philadelphia, philly.com. I guess starting next week, their school district is going to be canceling all of the weekend programs, and they're going to shut the school down an hour early so they can save about $2.8 million. Now, if you're an organization that wants to use the school, they say you can pay to use it. Sure, you're going to have to pay for it, but you can use it. And I started thinking about this. I'm going, that is fantastic for the right wing, because now you've taken the school out of the community. Because, when I was a kid, the school was part of the community. You went there and you did activities. And if I remember the 1,000 points of light, the Bush plan during the 98, late 80s, early 90s, midnight basketball, all that stuff. The right wing said, no, we want to make sure that you're the churches. So we're closing the schools down. We're going to make it less accessible to people. And the whole idea is, well, we need to save money. We need to cut spending. We need to cut utilities and personnel. So what do? They get rid of 91 policemen. So, and it's sad that schools need policemen, but you know what? In a lot of these city schools, you need to have it. So they've cut it, 91 of them now. They cut some office jobs. They cut some central office jobs. Police cuts, they say, are going to save $617,000. But how much is it going to cost by not having them there? So now they're saying that the cuts will make mandate that 100 schools have no permanent police officers. So there'd be nothing there. Now add this to the cuts that we've had already. You look at September, you look at December, you look at early January, tons of cuts. And you've got to look at it and go, you know what? We're doing a fantastic job of putting public school in a position to be privatized, putting public school in a position to where, you know what? Dump it. We don't need it. It's not working. It's broken because we've sufficiently starved it. And tomorrow, when the budget numbers come out and we talk about more cuts to public education, more over the $900 million from last year, where's that going to put us next year? How much more are my property taxes going to rise? How much more are they going to take away from education? How many more schools are they going to close? How many more schools are they going to stop offering programs? Until we just get used to it and we accept it, it's going to be privatized and profitized. And we're not going to get a quality education. We're not going to get a compulsory education. It's just not going to happen anymore. That is conservative world. Let's take a quick break, right back after this.
I ain't never been on welfare, and that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, singing in these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to Win,
the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Since December 18th, a couple dozen retirees of a Century Aluminum plant in Ravenswood, West Virginia, have occupied a median along Route 33. They call their encampment Occupy Century Aluminum and say they've taken this action to fight a company that has kicked hundreds of retired employees off of health care. After shuttering the West Virginia smelter in early 2009, Century Aluminum began terminating health benefits for retirees in June of 2010. After nearly 2 years of trying to get the company's attention, the retirees found inspiration in the 99% movement. Karen Gorrell, at 62, is the youngest resident of Occupy Century Aluminum.
It's easy to say retirees are losing health care. It's easy to say there's devastation created. But people need to know the real stories, the real true impact, one by one, of what this is doing to retirees. We had a gentleman that passed away, Sam McKinney, on February the 14th. It will soon be a year ago. And he had attended one of our meetings, and he was beside himself because his wife was very ill and losing her health care, and he didn't know what he was going to do to take care of her. And he ended up leaving our meeting. He was just next to tears, and he drove up the road with his wife to have Valentine's dinner, and they ate dinner, and he came out and died in the parking lot within minutes. And his last day on this earth, he had said to his wife, "The day I married you, I knew I could take care of you for the rest of my life. And Century has stolen that ability from me. And if I were to die today, I don't know what would happen to you." And that was Sam McKinney's last day on this earth.
Gorrell said the images on television of Wisconsinites fighting for their rights were inspirational. She said it helped teach the world that unless you use your voice, you'll lose your voice.
You know, I watch that every day on TV, you know, in Wisconsin. And my goodness, you know, the support and the love that went out to the folks there. I wanted to be there so bad. Of course, we were right in the middle of our own battle. But I wanted to be right there in the middle of it. I just wanted to be right there with you all. And, you know, I love what you're doing. And we're just so grateful and proud. And, you know, it's spreading. And if we all stand united, they can't beat us. You know, I always say, if you believe you can, you will, and if you think you can't, you won't. And we got to believe that we can take this country back, and we've got to unite and fight back. And it may take the senior citizens in this country, you know, that have endured and been through it all to be some of the leaders in this fight.
For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the most unfortunate situation that I have seen in a long time in Washington as a result of one or two people who just really were not willing to compromise. They wanted their way. And as a result of them wanting their way, 70,000 construction workers are idle in construction projects around America at airports, and 4,000 FAA employees are not receiving paychecks and haven't received paychecks for more than 10 days.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So it looks, you know, it was Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood there talking about the last FAA hostage crisis where the Republicans basically, you know, I kick fingers in the ears, kicking and screaming in the aisles, I want my way. And as he pointed out, there were construction workers who suffered. So I guess to be more bipartisan, and less divisive, I guess it looks like the Democrats may be caving on the FAA issue, not quite sure, hoping. But if you remember, I interviewed Congresswoman Schakowsky not too long ago, and she told me point blank, the Dems were going to stand, they were going to stand solid for workers on this vote. So we're going to have to get her back to talk about this. Anyway, I've got Shane Larson on the phone. He's the CWA Legislative Director. Shane, thanks for taking time for me.
No, thank you for making time. Thank you.
I'm looking at this issue, and it's something that I don't think most people understand what's going on. Originally, originally it was about the vote. If someone didn't vote or weren't there to vote, it was automatically counted as a no vote. Is that still part of this bill?
No, that will still stand. But unfortunately, as part of a quote-unquote compromise, Senate Democrats did cave into House Republicans' hostage-taking and agreed to some other rewrites to the Railway Labor Act, which is the law that governs organizing and collective bargaining in the airline and rail industries. And it's a step back. It's a rollback. First time in 75 years that the Railway Labor Act has been rewritten, and rewritten to the detriment of working people.
But it's not surprising to me, you know, as I was talking about earlier in the program, you know, these attacks, they haven't gone away. It's just incrementally, the right and the business-friendly folks and a lot of Bentney Democrats have allowed and worked towards chipping away all of the protections, all of the things that my grandfather's generation fought, bled, and died for, not just in World War II, but here on the job floor.
Yeah, no, you got it right. I mean, they are relentless. They are absolutely relentless, and they didn't get the big prize that they wanted of rolling back this rule that says that, you know, the votes will be counted in a union election, only those who participate. So they were unhappy that they couldn't roll it back to the old days where not showing up to vote meant you were automatically counted as a no vote. But they went at it in a different way. I mean, they're now saying that it's now going to take 50% of workers showing interest before we can hold an election. And, you know, keep in mind that when we file for an election with cards, the employer then presents a list of who they believe are eligible voters. And in some cases, those eligible voters are people who were furloughed 15 years ago. And if, you know, they'll chip away slowly to get us below that 50%. It sets it back the right to organize and bargain collectively. I mean, here just 3 years ago, we were talking about the Employee Free Choice Act, where if we got 50% to show interest in wanting a union, the union was granted. Now we have 50% to show interest, more than 50%, and that will take you to an election.
Yeah, but, you know, let me ask you this, because, you know, I've talked to a number of organizers who have said that they won't even file for election unless they get 60-70%, because they know that in the process from the day you say we're seeking an election until one actually happens, and who knows how long that's going to take, you need that additional number from 50 to 60, 70, whatever, just because the employer wears down and beats down and intimidates, the people who may have signed early on.
Right. And no, that's exactly right. And we do file with more than 50%, keeping in mind that it's 35%. And so they chip and chip and chip away and beat us back. So we always have that buffer. Now that buffer is much smaller now that the threshold is 50%. And it opens up the door for them to, through litigation, the carriers, I mean, they've got some of the trickiest lawyers that you can hire who go out there and whittle away at this. And through the discovery phase of litigation, they can go out and get the cards of people who signed and confront them in a court case. And so, you know, the Republicans were screaming that Employee Free Choice Act was going to be the end of the secret ballot. Well, here they go right now, finding a way through litigation to get access to find out which workers signed cards so that the employer can go after and intimidate them.
And again, you know, even if you're one of those people who may not care one way or another, this is another one of those issues where the power of workers is being swung. The pendulum is swinging completely to the other side.
Yep. And our big fear is that now we've opened up the doors. We've shown them a roadmap, the Republicans, of, you know, just hold one of these big bills hostage and, you know, and stomp your feet and shut the thing down. And eventually Senate Democrats will cave and make a progress. And the next is going to be the National Labor Relations Board, the National Labor Relations Act. They've passed, you know, almost 10 different bills in the House of Representatives attacking that. So they've got their roadmap now. This is how we chip away at workers' rights.
But at some point, I hope your members, I hope other union members across the country pay attention to what's going on, because and this is amazing to me, I've still talked to a number of union members who are still Republican voters, and they tell me that, yeah, well, they're going to be voting for the Republican because they're Republicans, not because they believe in what's going on, just because it's team sport.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And our members are outraged. And union members across the country are outraged. And that's why you're seeing hundreds of thousands of them take to the phones today and the emails and social media, et cetera, and saying, we got to draw the line somewhere.
Now, you know, a lot of folks say, well, why is labor, why are representatives of workers siding with the Democrats? You know, when you look at this, it looks like they're caving. I guess my question is, where do you go?
Well, we just have to make them, we have to, We have to go back to basics and create a movement. And we've got to, you know, realize that just because someone has a D after their name doesn't necessarily mean that they're always going to vote with us. And we have to keep the heat on them. We have to work to get our friends elected, and we have to keep the heat on them. You can't just assume that every 2 years when there's an election that your work is done. This clearly demonstrates that we have to constantly remind them that we are here, that we care about these issues, and you can't turn your backs on us.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Sean Larson, Communication Workers of America Legislative Director. You know, Sean, one of the things that I've been saying often is programs like what we're doing here are desperately needed across the country because the right got it. The right got it back in the 80s. We need to be in people's ears all the time. Even if they don't agree with us, we need to be there because you just need to push that message, and you need to have that that message out there so people absorb things through basically through osmosis.
Yep. No, and they're good at it. They keep up at it even when they're in the minority. They keep up at it and keep up at it. So when they get to the point where they can push it through, they do. They take what little incremental gains they can, and then when they're in power, they push it through. And so I have to give them credit. They have a very good machine in that regard.
And it comes down to this idea of constant funding, this idea of constantly pushing people out there. You know, I look at Philadelphia. They've got two conservative stations out there that keep pumping the message, even though Philadelphia's got like an 8-to-1 Democrat over Republican voter registration. But it's about pumping that message out.
Well, and, yeah, and I guess, look at it now with Citizens United 2 years ago, opening up the floodgates for corporate money.
Yeah.
I mean, we're drowned out.
Oh, absolutely.
We're drowned out. And, you know, we'll never be able to match them dollar for dollar. But, you know, at least those of us in the labor movement know that the best way to communicate is worker to worker, colleague to colleague, friend to friend, neighbor to neighbor. And that's what we need to do. We need to make sure that our folks are out there talking about this and the critical issues that are at stake.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. You know, this, you know, you look at all the attacks that have been going on. Do you see this as a really good opportunity to begin? And maybe it's a conversation should have been having for the last 50 years. But you know, what the labor movement has done, where we came from, where we're going, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, and it's just, you know, we have to keep working every single day. I mean, I know that folks get tired, but you know, if we let up, they're poised. They're just going to roll right over us and break the labor movement's back. And it's the only thing that's standing right now between complete corporate control of everything is the labor movement. And, you know, the charts show, if you look at any data, that the middle class was strongest when the unions were the strongest. And the income inequality was much smaller when unions were strongest. And the corporate interests know that, and that's why they are going all out, buying the political system and then using the political system to destroy the labor movement.
You know, like I said earlier in the program, you know, Ohio just had, we were in Ohio for the historic vote on SB 5, where the voters of Ohio said, no, we like our public employees to have collective bargaining rights. Thank you very much. Yeah. Now they're putting on the ballot a referendum, to make Ohio another no rights at work state.
Yep. And this is just a constant attack. It's in the states. We've seen it, you know, with the collective bargaining rights. We're seeing it with the right to work for less laws. It's just, and they're doing it on the federal level. It's just a constant, relentless attack. And, you know, fortunately, at least from our vantage point, our CWA's members get it. The steelworkers members get it. The UAW members get it. And everyone is, we're pushing back and fighting back. We need our working friends and family and colleagues to join us, whether or not you have a union, to fight back and realize that this is a class warfare. It is, but it's a class warfare that's been declared on us.
Absolutely. You know, and looking at this FAA authorization bill, to me, you know, and I go back to where I grew up in Ohio, one of the Republican representatives from the Cleveland area, Stephen LaTourette, you know, he said, look, $1 billion of infrastructure spending creates 42,000 jobs. To me, you know, they understand it. Why is it that we can't get a transportation bill pushed through? Why is it that we can't get this FAA funding pushed through? The only thing I can come up with is they want to make the guy sitting in the White House look bad.
Yeah. No, that's what it is. I mean, go back to Mitch McConnell's statement several years ago, the Senate Republican leader. I mean, he said their goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president. It wasn't to improve the country. It wasn't to make working people's lives better. It wasn't to rebuild our country to be competitive in the world. It was all about what are the Senate Republicans going to do to make Barack Obama a one-term president.
And when it's done, everything they can do.
Exactly.
Every delay, every roadblock, every gridlock, every poison pill, whatever they can find, they're willing to put.
They're throwing it.
Because you look, I mean, November of 2010, and I've focused on this quite a bit, they talked about jobs, 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 and I haven't seen anything about jobs. Here in Pennsylvania, they talked about jobs, jobs, jobs. What'd they push through week before last? Pennsylvania in this year is the year of the Bible. What happened to the jobs?
Well, that's exactly, I mean, all we've seen here in Washington is the, is cut, but cutting vital programs that actually help protect jobs and create jobs, and then union busting. Those are the only two things that this House of Representatives has been pushing. Let's go after the unions, attack the unions, weaken the unions, and let's go, you know, let's cut and slash. I mean, eliminating national public radio and public broadcasting. CWA represents tens of thousands of workers in those jobs. And they provide a good public service. And it's 0.00000001% of the federal budget. But let's get rid of it and hack it away.
It's the most important thing, man. You hear them talk, it's the most important thing.
Yep.
Last bit I've got for you. You know, I'm looking at this, and I'm looking down the road, and I'm going, you know, if it's not jobs, then what's the point? What are you working for? And to me, it's about completely doing away with any regulation that helps workers, that helps their families, and it's all about basically paying to the chair, making sure the billionaire class is well-funded, well-taken care of at my expense.
Right.
Simple, simple stuff. Shane Larson, I appreciate the time.
No, thanks for making the time.
Thanks so much. Legislative Director over at CWA. Quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Anyone who has participated in a public demonstration is used to seeing police with video cameras recording us commoners as we dare to exercise our constitutional right to protest. Authorities insist that being videoed should not worry demonstrators as long as they're doing nothing wrong. But what happens when the cameras point the other way? Cell phones and video cameras are now ubiquitous, so police agents frequently find themselves being recorded doing everything from traffic stops to arresting protesters. This has exposed police abuse and even led to some convictions of agents caught roughing up the citizenry. But it has also produced a police backlash against camera-wielding citizens. Across the country, irate cops have been arresting people for the crime of filming police actions. Such states as Illinois have outlawed the recording of police without their consent, while Maryland and Massachusetts have even tried to stretch their anti-wiretapping laws to prosecute citizen videographers. Some judges are going along with this, saying that, quote, meddling citizens should not be bothering authorities. As one barked from the bench last October, I'm always suspicious when the civil liberties people start telling the police how to do their business. Well, excuse me, your powder-headed honor, but us meddling citizens fought a revolution 236 years ago against King George III's red-coated authoritarian, so we could indeed tell the police how to do their business. It's the American way. This is Jim Hightower saying, the good news is that a federal court of appeals ruled last year that we the people do have a constitutional right to record police actions in a public place. After all, if they're doing nothing wrong, the authorities should not worry about anyone videoing them. The camera is simply a democratic tool. It empowers citizens to be their own watchdogs.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So it looks like on Friday, the Indiana Secretary of State, Charlie White, was convicted on 6 felony counts of voter fraud, theft, and perjury. And he was removed from his office. So yesterday he took to Fox News, because where else can he go to defend himself? He called Indiana a land of men, not of laws, and he vowed to appeal what he called a total miscarriage of justice and a perversion. He then went on to accuse Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, of similar charges, claiming the Indiana governor voted incorrectly in the last 10 straight elections. Both White and Daniels have made fighting the nearly non-existent problem of voter fraud part of their political agenda, which, you know, you hear the folks on the right all across the country pushing for these really, call it what it is. It's a way to suppress the vote. It's the way to keep the poor and the old, to keep them out. But the folks on the right, generally the ones doing it. And I look at this guy, you look at the guy in Wisconsin, who, when they went to his house to, you know, see if someone would be willing to sign the petition to recall him, turns out he didn't live in the house or in the district that he represented. He was living somewhere else with his mistress. So, you know, it's, well, it is what it is. Did you see the Super Bowl, the national anthem in Indiana? I think if the law were to pass, they should have arrested Kelly Clarkson, and especially the two before her that sang, Oh Beautiful. Really, lock those people up quickly. Quickly, quickly, quickly. Headline today, Pennsylvanians should prepare for dramatic and difficult cuts in the state budget, according to State Senator Joe Scarnati. And look, you know, as we've been talking about all day today, incrementally, they're moving us towards cut, cut, and punish. They're moving us towards making sure that our education system is totally unfunded. They're moving us towards a safety net that is, well, has gaping holes in it, much worse than we have now. All because you got a governor who said, you know, I'm not gonna raise taxes. We'll just make the states do it. We'll make the localities do it. Because as you look around, school district after school district having to raise their taxes. And I think the Democrats are right. I think it's shameless what they're doing. And as Frank Dermody said, a House Democratic leader, he said, look, since day one of this administration, Corbett has waged a relentless, all-out attack on Pennsylvania's middle-class families, including children, workers, and retired citizens, seniors. And the reality is, they're pushing what he called a mean-spirited and heartless agenda toward working families. Now, stop and think about the things that they've done. You know, right at the very beginning, they booted 41,000 people off of adult basic, and that recently they booted another nearly 100,000 off of the Medicaid roll. You got it almost $1 billion, $900 million in public school money. Gone, evaporated. And we've done nothing for our transportation needs, nothing whatsoever. You know, so what have the Republicans done? Well, you know, they've fixed that lawsuit abuse because, you know, that was a huge problem. They changed some casino laws. And of course they passed a budget on time. That's something, right? And I'm looking at this going, you know, maybe, you know, some of the comments I've been reading in these crazy blogs, are right. You know, we're paying these people a whole bunch of money, to pass non-binding resolutions, like making this the year of the Bible. I mean, to me, I got some response from folks saying, well, it's not that big of a deal. You know, you've got to pander to the simple-minded. You know, I kind of get that, but you took time to do it. And they're out there pushing this frame that, well, you know, we're broke. We're not broke. You know, the money that we borrow, we pay at such an extremely low interest rate on. We're not broke. But they keep pushing it. And they keep saying, you know, we got to tighten our belt. We got to make things tighter. And then they push out these ideas that, well, you know, we got to tighten our belt, you know, like the email I talked about earlier. You know, we got shared sacrifice. You know, times are tough. Got to roll up our sleeves and, you know, all share in. Because half the nation's paying for something that they're not getting, that they're not getting. Half the nation's getting a whole bunch of stuff they're not paying for. You know, because all these people are out there fat and happy off of government largesse. And the more I look at it, I go, you know, we're gutting social programs. We're gutting education. Why? Simple. Want to set it up for your vulture capitalists. And I was reading the story today over at edweek.org that you can't argue with. It's the new marketplace. You're seeing a huge flow of venture capital into education. And why? You know, you think you pay money into something and you're getting something for your kids and you're getting something for your community. Is there some for-profit motive? And I don't think there is, but the venture capitalists think so. And, you know, I started going back through and thinking about all of the discussions on what we should be doing in schools, what it should be focusing on. And, you know, I kind of came to a place where maybe things would be easier for a short time if we just went the fascist route. We just handed it over to venture capitalists. We just handed it over to the conservatives who, the authoritarians who just rule. Because evidently we have lost our minds when it comes to issues that affect our lives. We're easily strayed by nonsense. And under the meme of we're saving money by cutting people's education. We're saving money by kicking people off of health care. We're saving money by taking food out of the mouths of children. Somehow that has flown in what we call today news. And the Republican meme over, well, we're saving money, but we're not investing. And I go back to this commercial with this Pete Hoekstra that just blows my mind that someone would run on a platform of, you know, I'm not spending any money. I'm Pete Spend Not. You know, she's Debbie Spend It All or Spend It. Well, here's the commercial. Oh.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spend It Now. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy get very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spend It Now.
I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spend It Now and Pete Spend It Not. I'm Pete Spend It Not Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
And that could be Tom Spend It Not Corbett, because he's saying, well, we're broke. We don't have any money, so we can't invest in education. We can't invest in roads. We can't invest in bridges. We can't invest in our infrastructure. So what happens? Everything crumbles. I mean, the Chinese girl should be rolling up going, hey, stupid people, thank you for having a crummy infrastructure. Thank you for screwing up the network that has been the envy of the globe for 50 years. Thank you for doing that. Thanks for having Tom Friedman run around saying that he flew out of Beijing to LAX and it was like coming from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. Thanks a lot for that. Because we're not investing in our future. We're not investing. Because, oh, we've got this. And they've done a great job of convincing us. Even people who I thought were semi-intelligent are saying, gee, Rick, you know, we're broke. There's no money in the checking account. And I'm going, duh, wait a minute. So you're going to not invest? If you had a huge hole in the roof of your house, would you not fix it because, oh, I'm broke, I don't have the money to borrow to fix the roof? Well, that's what we're doing. But no, I'm Pete Spend It Not. And really, is that what our political system has degraded into? That kind of nonsensical advertisement? That kind of ridiculous? Is that where we are? Is that how far we've fallen? Is that where our intellect has taken us? I sure hope not. And I hope he's defeated soundly for just being stupid or thinking that we are. Either that or just xenophobic. There's a part of me that throws that in there, too. The whole thing was just to kind of stir up that anti-China sentiment. And look, I don't have a problem with China. I have a problem with us allowing China to beat us up. I've got a real problem with that. But he's, yeah, he's some card. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky ones. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
New evidence from meteorites supports the ongoing speculation that life on Earth might have been seeded from outer space. Earth Sky spoke with Michael Callahan of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, lead author of a mid-2011 study.
Our research results have shown the nucleobases, which are the building blocks of your genetic material, DNA, are found in meteorites.
The evidence, said Callahan, comes from 12 meteorites, 9 of which landed in Antarctica. They contain not only the chemical building blocks of DNA, but other molecules produced from simple ingredients found in space, such as water and ammonia.
Now, if those components can be used later on, which is what the idea is why this would be so important, that, you know, these meteorites could have brought in some essential ingredients that may have assisted the origin of life.
Callahan spoke of an intense period of meteorite impacts on both the Earth and the Moon around 4 billion years ago.
So maybe these meteorites flying all over the universe, impacting different objects and bringing in some pretty important things. And if maybe the conditions are right, maybe the same sort of process for life could be happening elsewhere. So the likelihood of life elsewhere has kind of increased just a little bit more, I think.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us. And you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80. You got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere.
You hear the right with their battle cry for privatization. Or, you know, here we're talking about public-private partnerships. Still, I mean, we haven't gotten it through our head. And you just heard Donna Cooper, who was part of the Rendell administration, said, you know, when they wanted to privatize the turnpike, the people who were going to give them money, who were going to buy it, lease it for the time period, they not only wanted the guaranteed profits and the money back, they wanted the profits that they would have gotten elsewhere guaranteed as well. I mean, it's masterful, and it's a game that they've set up that they win all the time. Amazing stuff. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Early budget numbers in, leaked from the budget here. $83 million being reported as what they're going to gut from higher education. And yet I've still got T-Twits telling me there's redistribution of wealth going on, Rick. Yeah, that $83 million they're going to cut from higher ed, that's $83 million coming out of the working people of this country, of this state's pockets, to put their kids through school. It's a damn shame, I'll tell you. A lot of things are a shame. That's why I've asked Mike Konzel, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, to come talk to us a bit about the series that the Roosevelt Institute and Salon are running together, the 99% Plan. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this this whole privatization scheme, as Donna Cooper said in the intro, you know, they not only want profit, they want profit that they, well, may have gotten if they use that money somewhere else as well.
Right. There's all kinds of ways in which these things are just set up to line the pockets of certain third-party agents. And when we think about that, you know, it's not like, you know, hiring these people makes a lot of these things cheaper. So it, in fact, will end up costing people more to have private provisioning of these services because you have to compensate all these third parties in really obtuse and ways that just go straight to shareholders.
Yeah, but, you know, but Mike, private is always better. I mean, they've done a masterful job of drumbeating that private companies, for-profit companies, much better than those lazy, you know, public people.
Right, right. It goes right along with this kind of market worship of our current political imagination. And, you know, there's beyond, you know, it fails every time we see it. We look at places like, private firms in Iraq and Afghanistan. You look at it in the private rebuilding of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. You look at it at all these studies that show private firms actually cost quite a bit more than government work. But it's also a problem in theory, right? Because it's also, it really undermines democracy. It really undermines accountability. And it really is still, and it basically creates all kinds of new problems about people trying to rent seek and people trying to provide weaker services for working people at inflated costs.
Yeah, I've been saying, wait till, you know, you love privatization, wait till we privatize public education, which here in the state of Pennsylvania, they are going full tilt boogie towards, and want to have it in the worst way. And, you know, I tell people, parents, you know, wait till you decide you want to complain. They're going to tell you to sit down and shut up because, you have no say here.
Yes, and I'm not from Pennsylvania, but I believe you have a brand new Republican Congress. Is that correct at the state level?
Well, we have completely controlled, steamroller proof. They can roll over us with anything that they possibly want here in the state of Pennsylvania.
And it's super important that progressives and liberals are, you know, the broader liberal left. Thinks about these things and engages them because the right is so coordinated and so organized at the state level on these things, in part because a lot of corporate interests want to make a lot of money, so nothing like making tons of money for free off taxpayers is a great motivating tool. But these battles are taking place at the states, and I don't think people quite understand how deep they are, how hard they'll be to reverse once they happen, and what the stakes are for the lives of working people in this country.
I mean, because once you privatize something, it's rare you ever get it back. Once you put it into the hands of the profiteers, good luck, and if it does come back, it's going to cost you twice as much to bring it back up to standard anyway.
Absolutely, and in that time, you're going to basically see a lot of the stuff essentially strip mined. It's like we're lending them forests that they're going to tear to the ground, right? If we give them our schools and try to get them back, you know, you're going to see all kinds of reorganization that's about generating inequality, generating hierarchy, and basically grabbing resources and capital from every place that they can find.
You know, I was in Wisconsin for the occupation they had there a year ago, and I went to the one tire shop to get my oil change, and there was a guy in front of me who was retiring as a state worker, said, I got to get out of this insanity, and had found a job doing the exact same thing that they were doing away with on the state level for the private company. So he was just moving, he was doing the same job, but just moving from the state public sector over to a private sector. He was telling the guy behind the counter that he was going to take his retirement, and he got a raise almost double of what he was making for the state.
Wow. Well,
and the guy behind the counter was upset that the guy was getting his pension.
Well, and the thing is that, you know, some people are going to win a lot and some people are going to lose a ton too, because there's also people in Wisconsin who are in prison who are going to take over jobs for, you know, 80 cents an hour or 40 cents an hour, under the really repressive terms of prison labor for government work as well. So, I mean, there's all kinds of winners and losers, but it's important to kind of step back and just think about what is happening at a grand level, right? So, you know, there are all kinds of ways that we as citizens of democracy have evolved to hold government accountable. There's both elections, but there's also FOIA requests. There's also other accountability measures.
Right.
It's in the Constitution that, you know, the government should actually be responsible for administering its services too. And that's how all these laws come into being. But none of them are going to be compellable. Or as the law stands right now, and it is unlikely that the Roberts Court is going to go against corporate interest in the next few years.
Well, they haven't.
They certainly have not, and it would be very interesting if they did, but I'm not holding my breath there. But, you know, that private company you can't do a FOIA against. You can't, you know, hold a public hearing and demand accountability as you can under democracy if that thing was still a public service. So, you know, beyond the cash, which is a huge motivator for people, there's all kinds of other things that are really offensive to a democratic country.
Yep.
That happens with what's going to be going on in privatization the next few years, and it has been going on for many years.
I'm right there with you. And the reason I brought that up is, you know, it was the response of the guy behind the counter that caught my attention. It wasn't the fact that, you know, the guy who was taking this job was getting more money. It was the response that, well, he's going to get his pension too. And it didn't dawn on this guy that the service that the state was getting was going to end up costing twice as much. It was going to cost more by privatizing it. He was worried about the guy actually getting his pension and still having a job.
Right. And, you know, right now it's still, you know, still very, very terrible economy for most people. And, you know, people don't feel particularly generous right now. People do not want to expand the welfare state. People do not want to particularly look out for each other when, you know, unemployment's so high, when people are incredibly concerned about their homes, about their retirements, about their children, about their access to basic goods and services. So it's exactly the moment when cynical politicians can say, you know, there's this huge free lunch waiting for us. If we just sell off our bridges to this company, if we sell off our parking meters to that company, if we sell off our administration of our schools to this consultant group. And, you know, people might say, well, it looks like it saves money, which is, you know, off my back. You know, I think markets are going to do better than the government, which I'm mad at anyway, and they're going to find they're getting a really bad deal on this stuff.
Yeah, and the other part of it is you know, we'll get those poor people. They'll have to work. And I think most people want to work. They just the jobs aren't there. I mean, we've given trillions of dollars to the so-called job creators. What have they done with it?
They sat on it, basically. And they're in no position to create jobs when there's not customers out there for them, especially in the United States, where, you know, a lot of people are really sitting on, people are very nervous and they're not spending money. But yeah, there is also this break in how we view what the government does, where for a variety of cynical reasons, we think of the government as something that's primarily about ensuring basic access to the poor. That's kind of what Mitt Romney was saying when he hinted that poor people live this kind of middle-class lifestyle off the government. And, you know, people who want good roads, people who want good schools, people who want, you know, accountability in their government services, which is everyone, are going to find that they're going to get a really raw deal regardless of what percent of the class they're in.
Yeah, on Super Bowl day, Pete Hoekstra ran an ad in Michigan. I don't know if you saw it. Where he was calling Debbie Stabenow's Debbie Spend It Now, and that he was Pete Spend It Not. And to me, immediately it said, well, okay, you're not going to invest in all of the things that we need. You're going to continue us down the wrong path. You know, one of the quotes I've been using came from Thomas Friedman, who was giving a speech. He said he went from Beijing to LAX, and it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones.
Right. And you're seeing it. They're tearing up roads everywhere. You know, things are going to be sold off. I'm from Chicago originally, where there's a complete disaster in how their parking meters are set up. So they were all sold off to investment banks and third world investment companies. And, you know, people, you know, the most shocking thing, but it's not even the most egregious thing, is that if you wanted to have a block party, you need to compensate the bank and the holding company because they won't collect meters that day.
Nice.
And that's just so offensive that you need to essentially ask permission from the banks, who we have done so much for, to gather in public, you know, among your community. And, you know, that's just a microcosm of all the stuff that is happening and will happen through weak budgets at the state levels. And I mean, it's a problem in most states. You know, they can't, without the federal government, kind of swim through this recession. They're going to look for things like this to do, and you know, it's something that progressives really need to be engaged with.
They're going to figure out how to stick it to the 99% and not go after where the money is. And you know, I talk about redistribution of wealth all the time because I have a number of Tea Party types who accuse me of that. And yeah, I'd like it redistributed the way it used to be when there was actually a growing, burgeoning middle class in this country.
Right, and I mean, you know, look at something, you talk about redistribution, look at something like Scott Walker did in his original budget. It was a huge corporate tax cut, along with all these service cuts. So it's not like he's saying, you know, there's a budget gap and we need to balance on the back of the poor. It's that we also need to give a gift bag to corporate incomes, right? So it's beyond just a war on the poor, or poor and working people. It's also a war to really shovel benefits up, you know. Romney and all these Republican governors are in Republican congresses are, I mean, look at where their priorities are. It's all, defunding Planned Parenthood and reproductive access. It's all right to work laws. It's all energy deregulation and privatization. It's all selling off state assets and, crony no-bid contracts. It's really, they talk about, responsible budgetmanship, and, I'm not against having responsible budgets. I'd like to see them be much different. But what I really, when you step back and look at it, you see that there's just a whole class war going on across the board with, at many of these state levels.
Yeah, I'm in favor of
paying, too.
I'm in favor of paying my bills like we do in the Smith household, but when there's a hole in the roof, you got to fix the hole in the roof.
Exactly. And, the government's not like a household. It does the opposite of it. It should balance out how if everyone saves at the same time, that's going to cause a deeper recession. This is something we suffered for a decade through the Great Depression to understand, that when private individuals are saving, which they're doing right now because, for a variety of reasons, and that's right and correct, the federal government should step up and spend more. I mean, this is basic economics, and it took a long time to learn it, and it's amazing how quickly we've unlearned it.
Yeah, but Mike, we're broke. We're broke.
And we've never been richer. I mean, in terms of GDP, we've never been richer. It's just much more concentrated than it's ever been. And when it's that concentrated, it's bound up in our labor. It's bound up in capital gains. It's bound up in the stock market. It's bound up in the country as a whole. So, it's really important that, we build towards a longer future, and that requires investing in people now, both through job programs and education and having decent public services.
Yeah, but that would make us think beyond the next commercial break, and I don't know that we're really capable of that right now. So let me ask you, I got a couple minutes left, the 99% plan that the Roosevelt Institute and Salon.com are working on. Tell me about it.
Well, it's going to be over the next 4 weeks. A fellow here named Sabil Rahman, who's a brilliant young political economist, commissioned a bunch of essays. Mine was the first on privatization. We have some about how do we think of economic freedom and economic citizenship. And it's going to be a historical perspective. It's going to talk about how, different ways we've thought about where workers stand in relation to the state, how it's evolved over the last 100 and 150 years, and why our current fascination with meritocracy and markets and upward mobility often kind of ignores the fact that, not everyone's going to be in the 1%. We need to have some sort of broadly shared prosperity.
Yep.
There's going to be stuff that's kind of analysis about, right now is a very difficult time for liberals, right? I think President Obama is much more polarizing than people had imagined. I think the country is far worse than we had imagined. But we also need a game plan for 5-10 years down the road. And so part of this is in the middle of an election cycle. We're all going to be watching the next 2 weeks, the next 1 week, the next afternoon. In terms of the news cycle, this encourages us to look a little bit further ahead and realize that there is a long game that we're playing as well, because the right is playing that game.
Well, they've been playing that game for 40 years, and we just evidently didn't notice.
We're always a little too confident. We're always calling, to use the Bernanke phrase, we're always calling for green shoots a little too early. Like Obama was green shoots. We've ended the Republican dominance of the country. And it turns out that wasn't true. And so we need to constantly be firing on all cylinders. So we need a long-term game plan as well. And we're hopefully going to put out a couple essays that will be useful for that. And I hope everyone there'll be one a weekend on Salon. You can see it if you Google a 99% plan at Salon. And I hope your reader, or I hope your listeners check it out.
We will make sure that we get some links over there because, in what you laid out is what I've been talking about. My grandfather's generation would have never gone for this nonsense that we're going through right now. At least I don't believe he would have. But it'll be interesting to see what you guys come out with. Again, the 99% plan. We'll get some links at thericksmithshow.com as this comes out. Mike Conazzo, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
It is believe that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. A new Washington Post ABC poll out showing President Obama holding a clear lead over Mitt Romney. Also, a 2-1 margin. Americans are saying that the more they learn about Mitt Romney, the less they like him. Not really the kind of messaging you want going into the summer. The same polls also show 68% of Americans think that the tax code favors, well, the very wealthy, including 56% who strongly believe so, while two-thirds of the folks think Romney is not paying his fair share of taxes. So, again, you know, you look at all the things that Romney he's doing, not so much, huh? And, you know, you look at Nevada, where he won handily, and, of course, you knew he was going to. Nevada has a large number of Mormons there, so, of course, they're going to come out for him. What has struck me is the numbers that of people coming out have actually gone down. And in Nevada, went down considerably from 2010 to 2012. 2010 was not a presidential year. I mean, generally those midterms are well down anyway. I'm still waiting to see what the 2008 numbers were, because look, the excitement's not there, and I'm happy to see that. I am happy to see them having troubles getting people out. And I loved what the one strategist guy said. He goes, "Well, you know, the people who didn't come out, they secretly support Mitt Romney." But really, they secretly do? And you know this how? Explain that. How do you know that the people who didn't come out, the people who decided, "No, I don't care. I don't give a damn. He's not me." How do you know they support him? And the more people I talk to, you know, I bring up Romney's name and they just kind of go, "I don't know. He's not one of us. He doesn't know what I'm doing. He doesn't know the struggles that I'm going through." And I can't imagine that, you know, people think any differently of Rick Santorum, Mr. Sweater Vest. And in fact, this weekend he took a tour of the place that made him famous. or I guess he made them famous for their signature sweater vests. So, you know, good for him. The numbers in Minnesota, though, pretty good for Santorum. Because Romney's in second behind Santorum, it looked like. Santorum's up by a small amount. But still, I mean, kind of wonder. Santorum, what, 29%? Romney, 27%. Paul, I think, somewhere in the 18%, 12-18% range. So, should be interesting to see where this goes. I'm hoping more money comes into the coffers of Santorum and Gingrich. And why would I want that? I want the race to continue. Because if you've seen the messaging, evidently Romney has decided that he's not going to be answering questions, I guess. Did some snubbing of some folks. And if I were him, I think I would stop answering questions altogether. I would just do my little press events. I would do my little things. And I would gather the sheep and get the flock out as quick as possible. Because the more he talks, the more he has to answer real questions. Because, you know, our media is not going to ask the real tough questions once he's decided. Once this whole thing is over and Gingrich is no longer there to, you know, to go after him, you know, our media is not going to be asking the tough questions. They're just going to be the stenographers. And then he's going to run that campaign that brings him back to the center, that, you know, makes him look like, and it'll be interesting to see how well the Madison Avenue executives do in reframing his image after this debate, after these debates and after all this whole process is done. Because he's going to have to come back and say, hey, you know, I'm like you, and pander to the base of the Republican Party, which, you know, good luck on that one. But he's going to have to, and it's going to be interesting to see how they do this. And as I'm watching this go on, I'm enjoying the fact that right now they're eating their own. And I'm enjoying the fact that all of his Bain Capital stuff has come out. And I'm enjoying the fact that, you know, now you can focus on that issue. And something I've been talking about for years. You know, why is it that you have these guys, these handful of executives, these big vulture capitalist groups who come in, suck everything out, and take off? Which is something they've done a fantastic job of doing. And look at him, quarter of $1 billion. And he's not even the big one. He's just a guy who made a couple of bucks, and I'm going to take it easy. So as this continues over the summer, I'm hoping that our media does something. I don't think it's going to happen. He's going to schedule Bush-type events with heavily vetted crowds. He's going to schedule events with, you know, folks who are you know, basically going to toe the company line, and it'll be, I'm hoping people are paying attention. And I'm hoping that right now people are paying attention. Because what's happened is pretty remarkable in my opinion. They have killed their own candidate. And I'm still hoping that in this investigation, the Justice Department is going after the Swiss banks. I guess they're investigating 11 Swiss banks. I'm still hoping he's got money tied up over there. I'm hoping he's got money hidden away. I'm hoping it's one of those, I'm hoping it's the October surprise. Because it'd be nice for once, don't you think, to see the Republicans get bitten by their own October, their own advent, the thing that they created. I think that would be pretty remarkable. And I think that's what it's going to be. It's going to be over money because, you know, as the economy is starting to do better, you know, Obama's going to be able to claim, yeah, we're creating some jobs, things are in the right direction. And I think they are. And again, not fast enough, but I think we're moving in that direction. There's only so much you can do when you have an entire party of people who are hell-bent on your destruction, and you've got the business class, you know, the big ones, the big multinationals, who, you know, they want the other guy because so they can rape and pillage. So they can profitize and privatize and get it all for themselves, which they have had pretty good success at over the last 30 years. So as we move further towards the election, the primaries coming to a close down the road, it'll be fun watching, and we hope you'll be here. Because, you know, this idea that we can move to this no rights at work nation scares me. And I'm hoping we're paying attention. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale about the unemployment thing on Channel 21. You know, it just blows my mind that they're putting a criminal on TV saying, well, you know, he broke the law, and here's him admitting it, but they haven't turned him in. So when we come back, we're going to talk to Rick Bloomingdale about that. Stick around. Right back after this.
Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Since December 18th, a couple dozen retirees of a Century Aluminum plant in Ravenswood, West Virginia, have occupied a median along Route 33. They call their encampment Occupy Century Aluminum and say they've taken this action to fight a company that has kicked hundreds of retired employees off of health care. After shuttering the West Virginia smelter in early 2009, Century Aluminum began terminating health benefits for retirees in June of 2010. After nearly 2 years of trying to get the company's attention, the retirees found inspiration in the 99% movement. Karen Gorrell, at 62, is the youngest resident of Occupy Century Aluminum.
It's easy to say retirees are losing health care. It's easy to say there's devastation created. But people need to know the real stories, the real true impact, one by one, of what this is doing to retirees. We had a gentleman that passed away, Sam McKinney, on February the 14th. It will soon be a year ago. And he had attended one of our meetings, and he was beside himself because his wife was very ill and losing her health care, and he didn't know what he was going to do to take care of her. And he ended up leaving our meeting. He was just next to tears, and he drove up the road with his wife to have Valentine's dinner, and they ate dinner. And he came out and died in the parking lot within minutes. And his last day on this earth, he had said to his wife, the day I married you, I knew I could take care of you for the rest of my life. And Century has stolen that ability from me. And if I were to die today, I don't know what would happen to you. And that was Sam McKinney's last day on this earth.
Gorrell said the images on television of Wisconsinites fighting for their rights were inspirational. She said it helped teach the world that unless you use your voice, you'll lose your voice.
You know, I watch that every day on TV, you know, in Wisconsin. And my goodness, you know, the support and the love that went out to the folks there. I wanted to be there so bad. Of course, we were right in the middle of our own battle. But I wanted to be right there in the middle of it. I just wanted to be right there with you all. And, you know, I love what you're doing. And we're just so grateful and proud. And you know, it's spreading, and if we all stand united, they can't beat us. You know, I always say, if you believe you can, you will, and if you think you can't, you won't. And we got to believe that we can take this country back, and we've got to unite and fight back. And it may take the senior citizens in this country, you know, that have endured and been through it all, to be some of the leaders in this fight.
For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Something I talked about last Friday, you know, it still blows my mind. A news station, mind you. When I emailed the folks over at Channel 21, I said, "Hey, I would expect this from your radio station. I would expect that from the right wing station there. This whole idea that somehow we need to destroy unemployment benefits. I get that from them. But from you, someone who's supposed to be in the news business doing honest investigative reporting, a little bit upset about your piece on people behind bars collecting unemployment, because it's a crime already. You should have just turned him in. I mean, if he's dumb enough to admit the fraud, Lord knows what else he's done. That's why I've asked Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, to come talk to us about this and a couple other things as well. Rick, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure. Glad to be on, Rick.
You know, I was fuming about this story. I came in Friday, and I was just out of my mind that, you know, they continually say, it's your tax dollars. We've learned criminals behind bars taking your tax dollars. And I'm going, wait a minute, unemployment, that's not my tax dollars, is it?
Well, it is in a way. I mean, it's not the general fund, but if you look at your paycheck every pay period, there's a little, I forget what the initials are, but we are one of three states where employees do actually contribute to the unemployment comp system, as well as employers. But in terms of, is it your income tax? No, it's money that you contributed specifically for.
I'm buying insurance. Comp. Yeah, I'm buying insurance.
Exactly, and that's what unemployment is. It's insurance against when you get laid off so that you don't end up losing your house and you don't lose your, you know, your car or, you know, your ability to make to search for work. So it's a good system that's worked well. And, you know, your reaction to that story was equal to mine. I mean, here's a guy that's clearly, and they were trying to sensationalize it, right? You're right. I mean, they should have just turned the guy in if they saw that he was breaking the law. It wasn't, you know, it's not that this is widespread. Here's a guy who lied and had his girlfriend filing his claims for him, which is another, is also against the unemployment law. So he's broken the law twice, and somehow that's the state's fault that this guy broke the law. Now, that'd be like blaming the state police for the guy who held up the, you know, held up the liquor store. If you could hold him up in PA, you can't because we get a great system, but guy who held up the convenience store, should I say.
Yeah.
It was just absurd. And then they proposed this goofy, what they say, simple solution of simply matching criminals, social security numbers against the unemployment database. Well, you know, that's not as easy as it sounds, given that, you know, and this was a county jail. It was DUI, right? The guy was laid off from his job. He was legitimately collecting. He got a DUI, went to jail, and he continued to collect while he was in jail, which he shouldn't have. That's wrong. That's against the law. WHP, Channel 21, should have turned him in immediately instead of protecting his identity in order to get a sensationalized story. And even when they tried to ask the guy, is this widespread, he said, Al, he really didn't answer. Yeah, I heard a couple other guys saying that they might have done it.
It's an unwritten rule, he said.
Yeah. Is that what it was?
It's an unwritten rule.
But, you know, back to the, you know, and this attack on public employees has been going on for, you know, the last year. Now they say, well, let's set up a system that's going to require more public employees, which is, you know, great for it put people to work.
Sure.
And it's a good thing. So, but trying to match, given that there are 67 counties, right? And like I said, this was a county crime, 67 counties probably processing 100 or 200 inmates a month or a week or however many. I mean, it's more than just simply saying, oh, it's one guy. Let's check his social security number. Against 99,000 people a week who are applying for benefits, that's a hugely labor-intensive process. And saying, well, why don't they just program the computer? Well, that's another expense for the taxpayers to bring 67 different county computer systems into line with the states, which, you know, we can't get our counties to talk to the state about their court systems, let alone having a unified criminal system plus the UI system, though. I mean, it should be done, but it costs money, and if people are willing to spend the money on that kind of thing, but they should understand it's not just something that can easily happen. I mean, clearly nobody should commit fraud. People shouldn't lie, and people should he should have just said, look, I'm not available for work and not filed for benefits that week. Now, if 21 turned him in for the criminal that he is, he's gonna end up with a fraud overpayment. He's gonna have to pay it back. He'll get penalty weeks based, you know, so when if he applies again, he won't be able to because he's, you know, paying for his crime. So there's adequate protections. I mean, it was just a goofy, let's try to eliminate unemployment story again. If we make it sound like everybody's cheating, one guy in 67 counties, maybe we can get benefits reduced. Maybe we can take benefits away from people who legitimately need them.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because as I'm watching throughout the night, because they had this, you know, the woman anchor come on and say, oh, at 11 o'clock, you're going to be fuming that these convicts are behind bars getting your money. Tune in. So I tuned in, and what I saw was, well, yeah, this is what happens when people break the law. People find out, they get caught, and they get dealt with. As I'm watching this, I'm going, this is much more beyond just sensational journalism. I'm personally thinking that this is all part of the behind-the-scenes working to begin to destroy or continue to destroy unemployment benefits in this state and across the country. It just seems too well orchestrated in my mind.
Well, given the level of investigative reporting, I hear your concern, but it just seems like maybe incompetence on their part. There's no question that there is an attack. And it's almost like, because Fox News gets high ratings for cable, sometimes it seems like our local news stations now want to be, not fair and balanced, as Fox claims to be, but isn't. But how do we sensationalize it? How do we go after a system that has benefited hundreds of thousands of people during this recession, kept many, many small businesses alive because unemployed workers in a town where a mill shut down have some money to be able to go to the grocery store, go to the drug store. You know, when people spend their unemployment, they don't put it in the bank. This is a system that it wasn't just created to help the unemployed. It was created to make sure that there weren't more unemployed. Because if people are unemployed, they stop spending, and that little, you know, it's not so much local grocers anymore, it's Walmart. But, you know, in the 30s when that was created, that money kept a lot of small businesses afloat. And as a result, they didn't become unemployed and put a bigger drag on the system. So, I mean, this is a system that really benefits people. I mean, everybody's unemployment, you know, nobody saves unemployment. It goes right back into the economy. So the money that you've been putting into the unemployment system as an employee, as you work, and your employer puts in, now is available to you, not anywhere near your original pay. At least it's at the most half your pay. Usually it's less than that. And so you have a little bit to keep your mortgage, keep your house, and put some food on the table for your kids while you search for jobs that we've heard there, you know, there's one job for every four people applying for it. So, you know, even though the job numbers were a little better, this recession is still taking its toll on families. And to try to further undermine the integrity of the system by having a story about one guy who gained the system, broke the law, and somehow that's the system's fault, it's mind-boggling. And, of course, they followed it up Saturday. Apparently they saw your email and my letter, and they, you know, because I chastised them for not, they never said they contacted Dell and I to try to get their side of the story. Apparently they did, and he mentioned that Saturday night where they had a mother who turned her son in for collecting, and who eventually lost his benefits, by the way. They admitted that, but because it didn't happen immediately, it happened when the employer filed, you know, their information about the guy's claim that the money was shut off. And that's, you know, employers, if they would file quicker, get the information in, you know, the UC system relies on information from claimants being honest, and employers being honest and quick about the claim.
Yep. And when you sign, when you call in there, you're saying, hey, this is factual. When you sign that check, you say, I agree to these terms. Everything I've said is honest and forthright. And if I'm not, it's a crime. So it'll be interesting to see, what happens. Will this guy be arrested? Will his girlfriend be arrested? Is he going to be a single guy? Because I know that when I was dating, if I got a girlfriend arrested, I think that would probably be the end of it. Which would be, maybe a good thing. Maybe these are folks we don't want reproducing. I got a quick question for you on the budget. I just saw something that may have just been early leaked. $83 million cuts to higher ed.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm going, wow, again, how much more cut and punish can we take? I mean, massive redistribution of wealth, in my opinion.
It is. And what we're going back to is a society where before we had unions and the middle class and the opportunity to send kids to college, going to college was very much what the elite did. With the wealthy, that their kids went to college. Steel workers kid, a public employee, guy, driving a PennDOT truck, or the guy working in the welfare office or at the wastewater treatment plant or in the Hershey factory. Traditionally, usually their kids didn't go to college. They might follow them into the mill and, have a good life that way because there were unions, but it became the American dream to send our kids to college. And now what we're doing is we're making, by doing these cuts, of course, schools have to run. Now, are there places where they could probably, do some savings? I'm sure there are. They've built some pretty nice dorms and stuff with good union labor and helping put money in people's pockets that way. But, what you're doing is you're going to raise tuition. 83, that's a huge hit on any institution or any number of institutions. So I don't know how we continue to have affordable college. And again, what you're going to go to is, on one hand, you have, everybody screaming that our kids need to be upskilled. They need to have the education if we're going to compete in the world. But yet, we keep taking money out of public schools, higher ed, places where you need to get your kids these skills and education to be competitive in the world workplace, and you take the money away. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't say we need a world-class education system and then not pay for it.
Right.
There's an old saying, and I'm sure it's a conservative saying, you get what you pay for, and there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Unless you're Pete, spend it not Hoekstra, who's running an ad in Michigan against who he is calling Debbie Spend It Now,
Stabenow,
which is kind of, is this how low our politics have fallen? Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. I appreciate the time. Great talking to you.
All right. Always good to be on the show, Rick.
Thanks so much. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
And they're talking in the town square, in the town they're shopping. I hear them talking everywhere, they're talking never stops. But all their words are whispering won't make me go away. They need to hold the factory down and nothing left to say.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Anyone who has participated in a public demonstration is used to seeing police with video cameras recording us commoners as we dare to exercise our constitutional right to protest. Authorities insist that being videoed should not worry demonstrators as long as they're doing nothing wrong. But what happens when the cameras point the other way? Cell phones and video cameras are now ubiquitous, so police agents frequently find themselves being recorded doing everything from traffic stops to arresting protesters. This has exposed police abuse and even led to some convictions of agents caught roughing up the citizenry. But it has also produced a police backlash against camera-wielding citizens. Across the country, irate cops have been arresting people for the crime of filming police actions. Such states as Illinois have outlawed the recording of police without their consent. while Maryland and Massachusetts have even tried to stretch their anti-wiretapping laws to prosecute citizen videographers. Some judges are going along with this, saying that, quote, meddling citizens should not be bothering authorities. As one barked from the bench last October, I'm always suspicious when the civil liberties people start telling the police how to do their business. Well, excuse me, your powder-headed honor, but us meddling citizens fought a revolution 236 years ago against King George III's red-coated authoritarian, so we could indeed tell the police how to do their business. It's the American way. This is Jim Hightower saying, the good news is that a federal court of appeals ruled last year that we the people do have a constitutional right to record police actions in a public place. After all, if they're doing nothing wrong, the authorities should not worry about anyone videoing them. The camera is simply a democratic tool. It empowers citizens to be their own watchdogs.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I break against the rocks in the hot sun. I broke the law and the law won. I broke the law and the law won.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So I was reading the newspaper over the weekend, and this Komen thing has kind of taken on a life of its own, as it should. I mean, when you're giving money to a charity, especially one, you know, about breast cancer. You know, I took my daughter to the local high school girls' basketball game. She's playing, fourth and fifth grade basketball right now. And the league had a day to go and see the game. And it was, you know, the Susan G. Komen for the cure night, and everything was done up at pink, and everybody was, you know, trying to raise money for this. And, you know, I talked to a couple of people about the issue. And a lot of people, very strong feelings about it. And surprisingly, you know, there were people who, you know, the one woman said, you know, I'm not someone who is in favor of abortion. She went on this whole spiel. But to make the organization one that's delved into politics instead of, you know, women's health, she thought was a huge mistake. So I'm looking at the paper. And the paper says, you know, the headline, Some Unable to Forgive. And I'm going, really? You're going to write that article a couple of days after everything has happened? And you find that they haven't restored all of the funding. They just said they can reapply again, I guess. And that some of the local people will still contribute. But they haven't, you know, this isn't a full victory, if you will. So, you know, as I was talking to these people, you know, there was, I think, proper outrage. That they had worked for these, you know, this charity. They had donated to this charity under the guise of, you know what? We're going to take care of women's breast health. I'm going to make sure they get exams, make sure information is out there. And now you're politicizing it. You're pulling it into the political world where now it's about abortion. And this is what the right wing does masterfully. And is it any surprise that the woman who, you know, it was running the place, is now we find out later that, you know, she actually ran as a conservative politician or Republican under the guise of doing away with abortion. Is that surprising? And is it surprising that Ari Fleischer, Bush's press secretary, was doing some of their advising? Really? I mean, does it surprise us now that we find it's packed with right wingers? No. I'm not surprised at all. And if you look at it, you go through this, the woman, this Handel, she was behind it from the beginning. And they've gone through a bunch of emails and found this was her baby. This was this woman pretty much with a handful of other right-wing crazies who have ruined this group. And, you know, the more people I talked to about it, the more they said, you know, I never thought of this group as political. And yet we've done that. You know, because me, you know, someone said, hey, you know, we do this for this this you know, looking for breast cancer cure. Who could be against curing breast cancer? You know, who? Nobody. So what do? They change it. And now they've put it right dead smack in the middle of a political football that's never going to be won. This, understand, this abortion issue is never going away. It's a blinding issue. It's meant to completely blind us from common sense. Because there really is, other than a few people who are a little more thoughtful, there is no nuanced position. Either you're for it or you're against it. And the passions on the end seem to be extremely high. Personally, I'm pro-safety. I'm not in favor of criminalizing it. I'm not in favor of extending it, but I'm pro-safety. You know, I've got two daughters. If something were to happen and they were to, you know, at some point this happened in their life and they go this route, I want them to be safe. But there are those, and I go back to a friend of mine who, you know, was a good union guy, who said he could never vote for a Democrat because the Democrats were in favor of abortion. And we had this conversation, and I made this statement to him, and I said, you know, I personally I wish there were ways we could do other things, like, you know, have an economy that was a little more friendly to bringing children into the world. You know, maybe making sure that you have prenatal care, maybe making sure that you have some assistance when the child comes to help the mother adjust, to help some families adjust, maybe some help to let one of the parents stay home for a period of time, maybe collect something like an unemployment like they do in other countries. You know, be having really true family value policy to make child rearing, you know, a little bit easier, a little bit more accommodating. And he said, yeah, I'm all in favor of that. But at the end of the day, I'm still against it. I said, well, what if it were your daughter? What if, you know, she went and it was criminalized and, you know, either she had one and they locked her up or, heaven forbid, she got an infection and died, as, you know, my mother told me one of her friends had happen to her. And he looked at me, and this is what scares me about some folks on the far right. He said he wouldn't shed a tear. And that's how polarizing this issue is. So to see the powers to be pull this group into the middle of this, who I don't know one way or another, the woman who started it, where her political leanings are, but where this group has now been pulled is right dead smack into the middle of that tug of war. Because you're right, some can't forgive. Some on the left are not going to be able to because they chose this course. And understand, some on the right are not going to forgive any capitulation, any giving in, anything at all, because they're going to feel abandoned as well. So I feel sorry for this group, almost feel sorry for this group at this point, because they've allowed themselves to be sucked into the middle of really an unwinnable battle. And it's all because of this vice president that they hired on, who, you know, maybe they believe had connections, we're going to get him some of the Bush money. I don't know what the idea was. But at the end of the day, trouble, trouble, trouble. And now it's kind of caused a little trouble in my life, because my wife was a big fan. Used to do all kinds of things. Used to go to they used to do a scrapbooking for The Cure, which is insanity. You know, she would leave Friday night, and they would have from Friday night till Sunday afternoon, they'd be stuck in a room scrapbooking and doing all kind of fundraising and nonsense. And I'm going, really, trust me, insanity. But she would do it. And they would raise money, and there was a big presentation. Oh, we made all this money. And now, you look at this, and she's going, I don't know if I want to be in the middle of this. And me, I'm saying, I don't want any money being paid to this group. So it's going to be, it's one of those things. And I hate talking about the abortion issue to begin with. I think it's been decided. Now what I wish we would do is we would pursue policies, like I said, that would make, you know, the people on the right talk about family values. They talk about, you know, how much they care about children. Well, you know what? Why don't we pursue those policies? Tomorrow the budget's coming out here in the state of Pennsylvania. And when they come out with this budget, you're going to see front and center the priorities, the morality, whatever you want to call it, the family values of the GOME. When Corbett lays his budget on the table, he's going to tell you what he thinks of workers, what he thinks of the poor, what he thinks of senior citizens, what he thinks of the people of this state. Who are going to be the winners? Who are going to be the losers? Corporations, I'll bet you, going to win. He loves corporate people, not so much poor people. So we will find that out tomorrow. We're working on getting a couple of folks to come and talk to us about how they're going to be affected. I know the president of the higher education, the teachers union that represents the state college professors and faculty, going to be here talking about the cuts. Like I said, first report I've heard, $83 million cut from the higher ed budget. That, my friends, is a direct tax on workers and their kids. How much more student loan debt can they possibly take on? How much more? How much more can they possibly be heaped onto them? How much farther out of reach are we going to make higher education? That because they tell us, you know, in order to get the good jobs, in order to have that middle class job, you need to have an education, you need to have a college, you need to have something. So what are they doing? They're privatizing, they're profitizing, and they're putting it farther out of reach. And the state is walking away from it as well. So we're going to come, as I've been saying, healthcare is one of those issues that defines where you are in this world. If you have it, fine. If not, you're behinds out in the street. Education will be that other dividing line. Whether you can afford to get an education or you can't, especially at the rate that we're privatizing it and profitizing it. It's a damn shame. Quick break back after this. Stick around.
90% of the world. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth. Sky.
New evidence from meteorites supports the ongoing speculation that life on Earth might have been seeded from outer space. Earth Sky spoke with Michael Callahan of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, lead author of a mid-2011 study.
Our research results have shown the nucleobases, which are the building blocks of your genetic material, DNA, are found in meteorites.
The evidence, said Callahan, comes from 12 meteorites, 9 of which landed in Antarctica. They contain not only the chemical building blocks of DNA, but other molecules produced from simple ingredients found in space, such as water and ammonia.
Now, if those components can be used later on, which is what the idea is why this would be so important, that, you know, these meteorites could have brought in some essential ingredients that may have assisted the origin of life.
Callahan spoke of an intense period of meteorite impacts on both the Earth and the Moon around 4 billion years ago.
So maybe it is these meteorites flying all over the universe, impacting different objects and bringing in some pretty important things. And if maybe the conditions are right, maybe the same sort of process for life could be happening elsewhere. So the likelihood of life elsewhere has kind of increased just a little bit more, I think.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I got an email during the break from Andy, and it's one of those things, you know, when these radicals, when they get in the door, they infest whatever it is they get into. And as he points out with this Susan B. Komen thing, just another example of how they get in, and they, you know, he pointed out CalPERS, how when Schwarzenegger took over, he was able to appoint a number of people to the board, and they ended up purging all of the moderates, all of the progressives, anybody who stood against the radical right-wing agenda, they got rid of. And like he points out, you know, if you're a fascist Republican, you're going places, brother. But if you're not, well, I guess you're screwed. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
This Susan Komen thing, just, it gets crazier and crazier the deeper you get into it. And you find out that it was basically one woman who decided to pull this organization into a political battle that there's no way in hell they're going to win.
Extraordinary that one person can do that, really.
And then you find out Ari Fleischer was one of the people saying, oh, yeah, go ahead. Let's do some work for you.
Yeah, but isn't he kind of saying, well, it was sort of informal.
It was informal. It's kind of like Newt not lobbying or not doing anything with Freddie and Fannie.
Yeah.
Just nuts. So what's going on around the world?
Well, Ambassador Susan Rice, the ambassador to the United Nations today, urged Egypt to immediately release the 19 Americans who are being held and are facing trial under charges of stirring up anti-government unrest in the country. That includes the son of Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. She says that these Americans have done absolutely nothing wrong. They do what American and international NGO workers do in various different parts of the world, which is to support democratic development and civil society.
And if they say no, what happens next?
If they say no, then the trial looks like it will move forward. We don't have a date set for that, and specific charges don't seem to be leveled against individuals. It's all a bit vague. But, you know, the administration has been very strong in speaking to not only Field Marshal Tantawi, who's head of the whole shebang, but everybody on down from there and saying, look, if you do this, you've got $1.5 billion in aid. It's in jeopardy. Congress passed a law saying that you have to show signs that you're moving towards democracy in order to qualify for your aid. This isn't it.
Right. And I think the fact that it's Ray LaHood's son gives it a little more push from the U.S. government.
Absolutely. And that the Democratic NGO has Tom Daschle, former senator, on its board, and the Republican NGO has John McCain as the chair of its board.
Interesting. What do you think the chances are of them releasing these 19?
I think it's very hard to tell because there's over 40 altogether. At this point, I don't think the chances are very good right now because they're trying to say that foreign hands are behind the protests and the demonstrations. This is an old trick of totalitarian regimes to try and whip up support at home by saying that there's a foreigner out there that's fomenting everything.
That's the boogeyman. There's the bin Ladens out there.
Exactly. And in this case, this works in Syria. Assad's doing the same thing. The Russians have done this in the past. So Assad's doing it right now, actually. And in this case, the Egyptians are doing it. So I don't know that they're going to see politically it's in their interest to do it. However, they also called for a swift movement to presidential elections and for a quicker transition to full democracy. And at some point you could see some pardon.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. Did you watch the big game yesterday?
I did watch it.
Did you see the Clint Eastwood Chrysler ad?
I did.
That seems to be all the rage. And look, you know what? As I was watching it, I said earlier in the program, it seemed like maybe this was an endorsement by a Republican for the president.
No, it wasn't. Even though Karl Rove says he was offended by it, and says it's a sign of what happens when you have Chicago-style politics, the CEO of Chrysler himself says, look, it has zero political content. It was not intended to be any type of political overture on our part. We are as apolitical as you can make us. I wasn't expressing a view, and certainly nobody inside Chrysler was attempting to influence decisions.
Well, that's good. But, you know, I'm looking at this, and there's part of me that goes, well, if it were something political, I could understand it. Because the Republicans at the time, if you remember, were all in favor of letting them go down. In fact, I remember this guy, Zach Womp.
I remember Zach Womp.
Well, here it is right here.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Let them learn the lesson the hard way. Let them go bankrupt. Let them screw all those workers. Because, hey, in Tennessee, where he's from, the state of Tennessee gave Volkswagen $1 billion in subsidies and grant and all kind of stuff. That's, in his world, that's competing.
Apparently so.
Nuts. So back to the ad. Positive response?
Generally speaking, it is getting a positive response. Many people, I've talked to a lot of hosts today from both sides of the spectrum who watched it and found it very moving and powerful, and they didn't think about it having a political viewpoint until they were told that it did.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I was, the whole second half thing kind of, to me, kind of played into the, we're right in the middle of this thing. Why, why change quarterbacks midway? That's where my mind went.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Let me ask you this. The more I saw a poll, ABC, I think it was Washington Post, ABC poll today. The more people learn about Mitt Romney, the more they dislike him.
The more they dislike him. This is a bit of a problem for Mittens, as some people are rather disrespectfully calling him. Basically, the poll is showing that the president has an advantage if a general election were held right now. And, of course, that's the caveat, right now, with all the stars aligned in exactly the same place. But the more people hear about him, and this includes Republicans, they dislike him like 2-1. But, of course, the more they hear about Gingrich, it's 3-1.
Well, that's even better yet. But I think this thing's over at this point. But that's not a good place to be if you want to be the nominee. And I look at this and I ask the question, since Obama has kind of stiffened his lip and kind of steelied his spine a bit, is he going to be able to win back some of the blue collar white folks? Because I've always taken the position that, no matter what it is, people like me, white, blue collar guys, middle class guys, want somebody who's decisive, someone who's strong, someone who's going to fight for you. That's why I think a lot of folks like Chris Christie, even though he's wrong, I respect the fact that he is willing to stand up and fight for what he believes. Do you think Obama's got a shot with those?
Well,
he
did reasonably well in 2008. Dems lost them huge in 2010. In this Washington Post ABC News poll, when you dig deep, which is what Greg Sargent had the pollsters do, they say Obama's approval rating among these voters is 43-54. Now, that doesn't seem great, but things are trending Obama's way. This is his best level among non-college whites since early last year, and they're far better than they were at their lowest point in 2010.
And I would think that those are the voters who think more hand-to-mouth. If things are good today, they're going to stick with the horse that's good today.
Exactly, exactly. And apparently the Center for American Progress says that Obama doesn't have to win them all. He just has to limit his losses among this group to
right.
win re-election.
Well, because Democrats never really do very well with white working class folks, to be honest. I mean, most of the people I know, not so thrilled because they're viewed as weak. They're viewed as vacillating. They're easy to cave. I mean, I remember Dick Cheney, during the last administration saying, they'll cave. They always do.
Right, and of course Obama didn't cave over the payroll tax cut.
And now if we could only get him to not cave over extending the Bush handouts.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens. But that, of course, will happen after the election.
So any word on when the next scheduled debate is February 22nd. Will there be anything, after that, or do you think this is all wrapped up?
My understanding is that that's the only one that's scheduled, and I think Mitt Romney would be delighted to keep it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw a report today saying that, he's basically, he walked out of an event, didn't take any questions, and there's part of me that says this is the end of the question and answer service.
It is.
Now it's just going to be him doing the thing that they do. Vetted
yes.
crowds, scheduled questions, the whole theater.
The Washington Post has a piece today saying he last took a question from an audience member, from a voter, 3 weeks ago.
Wow. Has it been that long?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought in Florida he had maybe taken one or two. Maybe not. Maybe it was all staged. Who knew?
Yeah.
Beautiful. But I have really enjoyed the debate season. I think this is going to be the last time we see all these debates ever again.
I think they won't make that mistake again.
Yeah. Victoria Jones, always great talking with you. I appreciate the update.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And take your money. All they want to do is add up. And take your money. All they want to do is.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states filed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So our good father, our Father of the Year award has to go to the guy from Altoona, who in the newspaper today was evidently arrested for DUI while picking up his son from the police station for DUI. So the cops got your kid for DUI. You drive your car to pick him up while drunk. Somehow you just got to go, you know, somebody needs to shake this person. The 44-year-old father picked up the 24-year-old son. Turns out the son had a blood alcohol level more than double the legal limit. Dad was just 1.5 times. So, you know, I thought about that. I saw that. I go, Dad, you got to pick it up. You got to pick it up. Jeez, oh, man. Like they said, man, you know, you got to get a license to have a dog. And yet, well, it is what it is. I don't know if you saw the report over the weekend. Tim Tebow, evidently realizing he's probably not the greatest quarterback, may want to get into politics. They asked him if politics could be in his future. And, well, he says, yeah, it could be something. Yeah, maybe. He's already been dubbed the Mile High Messiah, so I can't wait to see the campaign ads for that. Now, does it blur the lines for you between separation of church and state? You know, a guy who used to put Bible verses under his eyes while he was playing in college? I don't know. Anyway, some good news came today. State law requiring American-made steel in public works projects was upheld in the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They've ruled that the law that Pennsylvania has, saying, look, if we're going to build roads, if we're going to build bridges, we're going to do infrastructural improvements, it should be with American-made steel. And I marvel at our court system. And the logic, I mean, that it was actually a question that we would be able to do that. This company, Maybe Bridge and Shore Incorporated, they make temporary bridges. You know, like if you're rebuilding one, you know, they'll make like little gap spans or something, whatever it is they do. But they've decided to go to the UK to get their steel. Somehow it must be cheaper for them to go to the UK than to get steel made here in Pennsylvania. Or maybe we don't even make it anymore. I mean, we've allowed our steel industry to be so badly decimated that, you know, maybe we don't even make the kind that they need, or in the shape that they need, or however it's rolled. Maybe we don't. And, you know, damn shame for us. And maybe we should go, hey, you know, instead of having someone do it overseas, maybe we should encourage it here at home. That's worth looking into. But of course, the court said, no, the state of Pennsylvania can most certainly demand that steel made in the U.S. be into their projects. And again, I'm just marveled that it's even a question. And it's a Delaware company, so it's not even like it's a foreign company charging the state, going against the state. It's an American company fighting against. I guess maybe I shouldn't be surprised, because for some it's just about the money. You know, these people talk about patriotism. These corporations wave the flag when it benefits them. But at the end of the day, it's about green. It's about how much coin are they going to put in their pocket. And as I read through this, I'm going, you know, I can't even imagine that it's. I cannot believe it's even an issue. But again, you know, they get their stuff made out of the country. So they said, well, we've been cheated, so change your law for us. And again, you know, you go back to this whole corporate personhood thing. How many of your rights can you afford to defend? How much representation can you afford? And you go back to the Palace book, the best democracy money can buy. Is that where we're at right now? Because it's amazing to me that any state dollar being spent doesn't have to be used to benefit the state, not just in what you're getting, but how it's produced. And we don't think about that enough, I don't think. Think about all the procurement we do, all of the purchasing that states and local governments and the federal government does. I remember we forget where we were. I think we were at the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit that Keystone Progress put on. It was 2 years ago here in Harrisburg. And they had someone from the census who had set up a table, and they had mugs and hats and all kind of doodads and whatnots and little knickknacks and stuff that they were giving people out to say, hey, you know, do the census. And I picked up a hat, I picked up a mug, and I'm going, you got to be kidding me. U.S. Census written across the hat made in China. The mug made in China. All this stuff made, and we're talking about we need to create jobs, yet we took the money, and whoever did that should be fired. But we don't think that way. We say, hey, well, how can I get the cheapest little product without thinking about the big picture in this? Because, you know, when we build roads and bridges and stuff, you go, well, we can get cheap steel from overseas without thinking about the multiplier effect of buying local steel that employed local people and all of that that goes into it. It's about the tip of the nose, man, and it's how we run our country. Because they've got us believing that we run our country like we run our household. That government is like the Smith kitchen table. When Rick sits down at the table with his checkbook or his bills, he goes, well, this is what I can afford, and this is what my bills are, and this is what I have to live within. But even at the Smith household, there are certain things that are absolute. The kids have to eat. Sorry, that's an absolute. The kids have to have medical care. Sorry, that's an absolute. The kids have to be able to go to school, so they're going to need school clothes, and they're going to need all of their supplies. And I don't know if you know it lately, but more and more, they're asking parents for more supplies. They're asking parents for more stuff. Because we got a governor here who's slashing and burning our education system. Why? So we can give out more tax breaks to the big corporations. Why? So we don't have to tax the Marcellus Shale. Why? So we can keep that magical P.O. box in Delaware open. So we can pander to industry, because we want to be business friendly after all. You know what we've been doing since 96? Well, for years beyond that. But this Ridge thing I found just blew my mind. You know, we're cutting taxes and we're cutting red tape and we're deregulating and we're doing all the things so you come here to Pennsylvania. And we've been doing this over and over and over again. State after state, municipality after municipality. Why? Because we want to be more attractive. We want to steal from others. Instead of creating something, we're tearing each other down. We're ripping each other apart. Why? Well, because we want to be able to have that ceremony so the politicians can hold up the big sign saying, I created jobs. Never mind what you took from somebody else. But as a nation, we lose. And all of this beggar thy neighbor and all of this race to the bottom and all this, hey, we can pass these nonsensical right-to-work bills so we can steal jobs from the next state so they can cheat their workers. Well, stop and think about this, Dodo. When you cut them down, you cut yourself down because the tax money that you would have gotten from wages actually went down. So as a nation, we're screwing ourselves. And nobody seems to be getting that. It's a net loss for workers in the nation. It's a net gain for the 1%. For the investor class, they're thrilled to death to have us fighting each other. They're thrilled to death. Oh, 10th Amendment, yes, states' rights. Let them fight it out. We're the only country in the world that goes, okay, we're going to beat the tar out of each other before we get to the actual fight. So we've already beaten each other senseless before we have to take on the Chinese or the Indians or the Germans or anybody else. And understand, the Germans have got the right idea. It's not perfect, but they got the right idea. We're going to protect what's ours, keep our people employed. The Chinese have the right idea. We're going to do whatever it is to keep our economy moving, to keep our people employed, to keep our people happy. It's that American politician who doesn't seem to really get it. And maybe it's the American voter. And I go back to what I said at the beginning. You know, my grandfather's generation, I don't believe would have put up with this nonsense. I don't think they would have put up with it. And in the research I was doing over the weekend, and I'll continue over the next several weeks, it was all right there. The attacks have not changed. The same verbiage is being used that was used 40, 50 years ago. The same irrational logic is still being used. The difference is, now we're thinking about it differently. We've changed our thinking to something that my grandfather's generation would have never understood. These attacks on unemployment. Never would have put up with that. Because they understood that under your feet, you need to have a floor so that you have the ability to bargain for better wages and hours and conditions. Because if they can create the desperation class that we're seeing today, if they can continue to push that and make people more and more desperate, grasping at anything, any lifeline in the sea, they got you. And we're almost at that point where they got us, man. You know, when I see that only 52% of the country approves, whatever the hell that means, of labor unions, it makes me go, what a masterful job of messaging the radical right has done in convincing people that something that benefits them is somehow bad. But it's been since the Powell memo. It's been since the right wing began funding all of the message vehicles that you see. All of the right-wing radical think tanks who keep pushing out, oh, we need to go back and let those children scrub toilets. That'll teach them responsibility. We need to do away with those social safety net programs because the free market should dictate. And we should allow the housing market to collapse so that investors can come in and sweep up the houses and rent them back. We would have never gone for that 40, 50 years ago. Never. But they got us thinking that way. In fact, what the assault lines are now is that the founding fathers would have been for it. You know, I get emails every day. The founders were for corporations. No, they weren't. Does anybody remember the little Tea Party thing? And I find it ironic that the Tea Party doesn't even know that the tea was, well, geez, you know, it's one of those things. Anyway, today on the program, Eric Epstein talked about the DeWeese verdict, guilty on 5 of the 6 counts, rockthecapital.com. Sean Larson was here from CWA, legislative director, talking about the FAA and what that's going to mean. We also talked with Mike Konzel, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institution, about privatization nation, which we're seeing going on. And in the third hour, Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, is here talking about the, well, the so-called news segment on Channel 21 here locally, that I'm just still scratching my head over, and I haven't gotten a response. I thought I would. I thought they would try and defend themselves. Maybe they have realized that they're flat dead wrong and beyond defense. Which is why that they probably haven't responded. So maybe I shouldn't hold my breath. Maybe I shouldn't at all. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get it. If you got a smartphone, Stitcher app, Stitcher. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the bitter sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the end.